Welcome to a special clinical investigator think tank on non-small cell lung cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. We gathered seven clinical investigators to debate and discuss the key new developments in the field and to highlight one of the most exciting areas. My co-chair for the event, Dr. Tom Lynch, presented a patient from his practice he first treated with adjuvant chemotherapy 6 years ago.
This is a 47-year-old woman who's an artist who presented with a 10-centimeter mass in her left upper lobe. And evaluation at that point included mediastinoscopy, which did not show any mediastinal nodes. She went to surgery, had a left upper lobectomy. And so I elected to treat her with cis docetaxel, 4 cycles adjuvant chemotherapy. She tolerated the cis docetaxel remarkably well. And then after her chemotherapy, about 6 months afterwards, I got a CAT scan, and it showed a little bit of vague schmutz or infiltrate in the upper portion of what would be her left lower lobe. And I thought, well, you know, it could be nothing. Repeated the CTs every 3 to 4 months, and I began to become a little bit more worried because the schmutz became a little bit more prominent. And eventually, after about 2.5 years of watching this stuff, I decided we better biopsy it. She started getting a little bit of shortness of breath at this point. Biopsied it, and it confirmed that what looked like infiltrate really was non-small cell lung cancer.
Adenocarcinoma?
Adenocarcinoma, non-small cell lung cancer at that point. We sent it for an EGFR mutation test at that point, and it was EGFR mutation negative.
No other sites of disease?
No other sites of disease. And just about that point, we were involved in the initial studies looking at crizotinib in patients with cancer. Now, crizotinib is a drug which was initially developed as a MET inhibitor. And we actually had a phase 1 trial led by Eunice Kwok and Jeff Clark at MGH, and Ravi Salgia from Chicago was involved as well. And in their trial, our thought was, well, this will be a good drug for gastric cancer, because we thought gastric and esophageal were going to be MET-driven diseases. And the other place we thought it might be good is it might be good in EGFR mutant cancer that has MET amplification. Let's take a look at it in that setting as well.
Before you get into the clinical part, can you go back through the biology a little bit in terms of why you were thinking these things, in terms of what the drug does, what the mutation
is? So it's a kinase inhibitor that one would consider a fairly dirty kinase inhibitor, maybe more like sorafenib that hits multiple different kinases. Crizotinib has very high affinity for MET, very strong affinity for the anaplastic lymphoma kinase, or ALK kinase. It has some affinity for ABL kinase. And so it's a fairly promiscuous kinase inhibitor.
Can you explain the mutation that's been found, specifically what it is?
So in lung cancer, so you got this anaplastic lymphoma kinase. And what was known initially was that if you take the, we're learning a lot about this concept of fusion proteins and what role fusion proteins have in malignancy. Fusion proteins bring together 2 separate genes that affect the activity of the active gene which causes cancer. So you take the ALK gene in the case here, and if you put the NPM or nuclear phosmin gene with the ALK gene, you end up with an anaplastic lymphoma. You end up with an anaplastic lymphoma, often of the mediastinum, which is exquisitely chemosensitive. These anaplastic lymphomas do very well with chemotherapy. And we know that the pathology of that is that the nuclear phosmin gene gets put next to the ALK gene and drives that process.
And that two being together makes a protein that fuses?
You turn on the ALK, the anaplastic lymphoma kinase, becomes the driver of that malignancy. If the partner gene is nuclear phosmin, it's lymphoma. If the partner gene is EML4-ALK, it becomes lung cancer. Okay, so the EML4-ALK fusion protein drives a lung cancer phenotype. And so that was found in 2007 by Dr. Noda in Japan. And so in 2007, he discovered that this fusion protein was a driver oncogene in lung cancer cell lines and in some patient cell lines from Japan. So we had heard this about the time that we realized that this crizotinib drug had activity against the ALK kinase. In fact, our initial thought was, let's get some large cell anaplastic lymphoma patients on this trial. The good thing is that these patients do incredibly well with chemo, and every one of these ALK positive lymphomas seemed to be cured with chemotherapy, and we couldn't find anyone who relapsed to put them on this trial. then it became clear, well, there's this rare subtype of lung cancer. And I think in this case, one of the real breakthroughs was work done by a guy named John Iafredi. John's a pathologist, trained in molecular pathology at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, and came to MGH and set up a molecular profiling lab. And John is one of these guys who really spent a lot of time developing a FISH assay so that he could actually show the EML4-ALK translocation. And he was able to show that you could identify patients who had EML4-ALK lung cancer. And what I did with her was I sent her tumor to John and said, hey, John, do you want to just see, you know, there's a possibility that she may have an EML4-ALK. And this is while she was on her, about her sixth week of erlotinib. And she didn't grow rapidly through erlotinib. She had what we probably would call stable disease. But he called me up. He said, Tom, he said, your patient does have the EML4-ALK. And we had already seen a response at Dana-Farber and a response earlier at MGH in this setting. And at that point, I decided, why don't we try putting her on the crizotinib phase one? It was a phase one trial at the time.
So what happened?
So I put her on the trial, and a very interesting story. I start her on the drug, and 3 days, maybe 48 hours after starting, she emails me and tells me that she's feeling wonderful. The drug is clearly working. At which point, I send back one of these typical doctor emails that says, oh, I'm great to hear from you. I think it's fantastic. But of course, it's too early to know about this, and I'm certainly hopeful, and we're all behind this. And she sends me another email, Tom, cut the crap. It's really working. And you know, she could see that I was coming up with this typical doctor speak. And lo and behold, 6 weeks into it, she had a near CR. In fact, as close to a CR as you're going to see in this setting.
Side effects, toxicity?
Side effects are generally well tolerated.
What did she have?
She had just a little bit of tiredness, which we see with a lot of kinase inhibitors. There have been a few cases of LFT abnormalities, but generally the drug is pretty well tolerated.
Skin, diarrhea?
She didn't have diarrhea or skin. There have been a few cases of diarrhea associated with it, but not anything that's shocking.
What's her current situation?
So then what was interesting, a year ago, about 9 months ago now, she and I did an event at Lung Cancer Survivors Day, which is November for Lung Cancer Awareness Month in Boston. And I had already gone to Yale at that point. And so she was coming up to the stage. And she was the highlight of the night because when she came up to the stage, she was using crutches. And everyone in the room just was quiet. And everyone in the room looked around and assumed that she was in the last month or two of her life. And she got up on the crutches and she got up there. And she started off, and you could hear a pin drop in the middle of the busiest shopping center in Boston. And she turned and she said, listen, I'm really sorry about this. She said, but I broke my ankle climbing down Mount Washington last weekend. So that tells you a lot about how she's doing.
Wow. And she's still in response?
And she was doing very well.
How long has she been on the drug?
So she was on the drug for about 23 months. Still is on the drug.
What does somebody do in practice right now, Mark, who has a patient, particularly one who's a non-smoker? And I guess we should say that, I don't know if you want to comment on the epidemiology that you all reported.
Alice Shaw had a nice paper in JCO where she reported the epidemiology. It appears to be seen in about 5% of lung cancers, about 20% of the EGFR wild types who were never smokers, tends to be more male, tends to be younger, but the caution there is early data sets, and that could all not pan out with larger numbers.
Actually, one of your former fellows came up to me at some meeting we did recently and was just chatting. What would you say to a former fellow who came up to you and says, what do I do now, Mark, with a patient who's a non-smoker, particularly doesn't have an EGFR mutation?
Well, you know, I think at the community level in practice, this is a huge issue with docs. And it starts with, you know, many people come to see oncologists and they don't have adequate tissue for testing. And that is an issue at the community level. And this word needs to get out to the people that get tissue for so we get it the first time and don't have to go back a second time and get that. But assuming that you have tissue, I think we have some advocates in the lung cancer community that want to test everybody for KRAS, EGFR, now EML4-ALK. Is that practical? Does it make sense? What clinical characteristics do you use to enrich the population?
And where do you get it done?
Yeah, histology, ethnicity, sex, smoking status. And I think, you know, we don't test everybody at our place, but we test lots of people, and we tend to rely on histology. We're much more likely to test in non-squames than squames. And much more, you know, if a patient shows up and has squamous and has his pack of Marlboros rolled up in his T-shirt, and I'm probably not going to test that patient. But
well, just to be clear, though, didn't you guys, Greg, report a bunch of people with EGFR mutations who were smokers?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, 85% of people who have lung cancer are former or current smokers, and the frequency of EGFR mutations in adenocarcinomas is approaching 20%. So there's a fair proportion of patients who have lung adenocarcinoma who smoke cigarettes who still have EGFR mutations.
I agree totally.
But it's a percentage game.
Right. No, but it's different. Like my last two exon 19 deletion mutations have been in people who have had 30 to 40 pack year exposures, but they quit in 1983.
Yeah.
So I tested them and they had mutations. So I agree with you. But in someone who has an 80 pack year, who's actively smoking with squamous histology, the likelihood of finding a molecular event that's going to dramatically change your management at that point is very low.
Yeah, and I don't think anybody's argued that they're relatively frequent in squamous tumors. The frequency of EGFR mutations and probably EML4-ALK is extraordinarily uncommon in squamous tumors.
So we test KRAS and EGFR, and if they are both wild type, we will test for EML4-ALK.
And what I didn't know was that, because until recently, it wasn't that easy to get the test done, but now it is, right?
Well,
commercially available?
It's commercially available,
Is it reliable?
That's more difficult to say.
Well, I think that's sort of an interesting thing.
You're saying it was so hard to do the thing.
It's a fish test. For the actual clinical trial, the confirmatory clinical trial, there's a diagnostic that's linked to the development of the drug.
Ed?
But they have to do it this way because the FDA will not accept a general CLIA-certified lab test. They have to develop their own kit, essentially.
I think it's worth talking about a little bit. This drug remains an investigational drug, and so the only access patients have to it is as part of randomized clinical trials or large clinical trials. And as we've mentioned, this is being developed with a companion diagnostic. So in those patients that you've got who've got 10 unstained slides available from their original biopsy, and you're in practice and you're trying to decide what to do to them or do for them, your temptation may be to send off the slides to Response Genetics to find out if they've got an EML4-ALK. The big downside from that is you may use up all your available tissue. And then when you find out the patient has an EML4-ALK translocation and you say, oh, I'm going to get them on this trial, you send them off to the clinical trial place and they don't have tissue. So they're going to have to go through another biopsy to get tissue to go on the clinical trial.
We just sent out an email alert about that the other day just for that reason, because if you're going to be on that study, you have to have it done through their diagnostic kit.
Rogério?
We looked at William Powell's editorial to JCO with sort of proposing perhaps a sequence. So do the KRAS first. If it's KRAS positive, you don't need to do EGFR or EML4, right? If it's KRAS negative, then you do EGFR. If it's EGFR positive, then you stop there. If it's EGFR negative, then you do the EML4-ALK. So, it depends on tissue availability, logistics, cost. There's different ways of doing this, exactly. But I think it's a revolution as to how people have begun to apply this to clinical practice.
But this is all temporary. It's temporary because in 18 months, patients will have whole genome sequencing done on all their cancers. And they'll come to you with a thumb drive, which has every possible molecular abnormality. So we're not going to have to, I don't think
But how much tissue are you going to need to do that?
I think you'll need some tissue, but I think this will be done direct to patient. I think it will be done in cancer centers experimentally, but I think there'll be enough companies doing it direct to patient where they will be able to get around the issue of having to choose between tests.
But you're going to need to have core biopsy type.
I think you will need at least core biopsy.
Mark?
The other point we should bring up is we have to engage the surgical pathologist, molecular pathologist in this discussion too, because right now a medical oncologist has to ask for this test. They have to think of it. They have to go through tissue. And it's not reflexively tested for like HER2 is in ERPR. So that's a different culture. Our pathologists have to buy into this and help us do this too and understand why it's important and all that.
Greg?
Well, I think, really we talk about time delay as a huge factor in molecular analysis for patients, especially for upfront therapy. And, that reflex testing drops that time delay significantly.
Because
if your bronchoscopist, the person who's doing the bronchoscopy, doesn't get the right tissue, then that's another problem. But, if the material is sitting in the pathology lab for 10 days or 2 weeks until you see them, and then Mark sees the patient and says you need EGFR mutation testing, and then they test it 10 days later, it's 3 weeks when it could have been available right at the start.
Right.
I just want to finish up with the crizotinib by asking you, Tom, to reflect on the data that was presented at ASCO and an overview of what we know right now about the clinical, particularly the clinical benefits of this agent. Because you talked about this woman, but what are we seeing in general?
Well, I think the thing that's so impressive is this woman's example is illustrative of how people do. So at ASCO this year, they reported a confirmed response rate of 55%, but there were five or six responses that had yet to be confirmed with a follow-up scan. So the actual response rate may well be in the mid-60s when we get the final data. The interesting thing is that if you look at the percentage of people who are still on it, 75% of the people were still on the drug who they reported, and it looks like the progression-free survival will be in excess of a year, although we don't know that. Progression-free and overall survival data is just too immature at this point. So the drug is now in a randomized trial in second-line lung cancer, randomizing people between chemotherapy and crizotinib, and there's a crossover allowed in that trial, but that's the main way of getting crizotinib at this point.
Mark? The other thing, just to expand what Tom said, is that the response rate to this agent seemed to be independent of line of therapy that you got it in. So people who got 3-4 lines of therapy seemed to respond as well as, I mean, they had very few previously untreated patients in that trial, but, you know, it looked like pretty consistent response rates across.
Correct.
Whether you got it first, second, third, or fourth line.
Similar to EGFR mutations.
Exactly.
Or erlotinib. So exactly. If you get the drug, it works.
So I wonder, we've talked about IPASS, and, you know, at this point, it's like old news, although, what is it, about a year and a half, if mm-hmm. you think about it. There's lots of people who are not that tuned into it, and we want to make sure that we get this message across, particularly because of the presentation at ASCO that Roman's going to review by Passiani, looking at the CALGB trial. But just sort of leading into that, I wanted Greg just to set the stage for the next few papers and topics we're going to talk about with his 63-year-old woman.
Sure. So this is a 63-year-old African-American woman. She's retired at 63, and she initially presented with left-sided chest wall pain. Upon evaluation, she was found to have a left-sided pleural effusion, and she saw a thoracic surgeon who evaluated her and then took her to video-assisted thoracoscopy.
Smoker?
She was a never-smoker, and the surgeon took a look at her, decided that she needed a tissue diagnosis and a needed management of her pleural effusion, so did the video-assisted thoracoscopy and took pleural biopsies and did a pleuridesis. So the pathology came back from the pleural biopsy as adenocarcinoma, and this is at our institution where reflex testing is in place, and so this tumor was automatically sent for EGFR mutation testing, and she was found to have an EGFR 15 base pair exon 19 deletion.
So I want to just dissect out the clinical non-protocol approach to a patient like this. Anything else you want to say about her before we sort of bat around the way you might manage this? I'm going to ask Ed how he would think this through off study. Anything else you want to say about her staging no other site of disease?
She did not have any other sites of disease. Her brain MRI showed no evidence of metastatic disease of the brain. On a social issue, her insurance did not pay for prescription drugs.
Her insurance did not pay for... What did they pay for? Not pay for prescription drugs.
She paid for all of her medical care except prescription drugs. For
she was working?
This was her husband's insurance that she was on.
And what was her lifestyle? What would she do?
She's retired. She has two kids. She's a homemaker.
So, Ed, how would you be thinking through knowing that this woman has an exon 19 deletion? And I'm sorry, was she symptomatic?
After the pleuridesis and VATS, she was well. No shortness of breath.
Very sadly now, since I know all this information about her insurance company. You know, it's quite unfortunate that that happens. And I've had this conversation with my patients is that doctors make recommendations, but insurance companies decide who gets treated. It's just really quite a struggle when you have drugs that cost. And clearly, this is someone, to me, it's a no-brainer. They're going to get an erlotinib prescription. And they go down to the pharmacy, and they're going to be told it's $4,500. And, you know, there's no donut hole, I assume. It's just, this is what it is, and it's going to be each month. And that's really quite unfortunate because this is clearly the correct therapy to start on this woman. She is not having symptoms. She could live a very non-IV sort of intrusive life, maybe even for a year or longer, on a pill that would cause acne and some mild diarrhea.
Could you just backtrack, though? I mean, again, we kind of take this decision, oh, you know, this is the way we do things now. But, I mean, it wasn't like that several years ago. Could you just reflect back on the key points that you would, you know, again, you're having a cup of coffee with a doc in practice in terms of why, in terms of what the IPASS study showed, everything other than the CALGB study and the other paper from ASCO that Roman's going to talk about.
Yeah, so this is an area that always perplexes us still, is that this patient has this pleural effusion, and this is the one that you feel the most struggle with, because pleural effusions in patients, when we're evaluating them, can either be very debilitating when they just continue to leak out fluid and patients become dehydrated and very weak. They need Plurix catheters, or they can be very quickly solved, very quickly, and patients have what is perceived to be a stage 3 disease, except they have seeding of their pleura. So again, that's 4 in the new staging classification. You know, we start thinking about chemotherapies at first. If this were several years ago, we would start a traditional platinum taxane, we would add bevacizumab to this patient, and then we would go. And they would get 4 to 6 cycles of therapy, continue with the bevacizumab afterwards, and when they progressed, we would consider our second line options. Being a non-squamous, an adenocarcinoma, we'd probably consider pemetrexed in someone like this. But I think as the data has emerged, and especially now the most recent publication out of the Japan group that was published in New England a few weeks ago that really confirmed, because that was actually the primary endpoint of the study, was it was a carboplatin paclitaxel versus gefitinib, and that was all patients with mutations going in, as opposed to the IPASS, which was a exploratory endpoint.
Just to clarify, though, in terms of, again, those two studies, now, IPASS, which was done in Asia, looked at people that at that point with a phenotype non-smoker more likely to be in the study, but they didn't have to have a mutation to get in there, but they did the mutation testing afterwards. And what was the primary finding there, and what was the primary finding in the Japanese study?
Yeah, so IPASS was designed as a large sort of Asian adenocarcinoma population who were light smokers. Mutational testing was exploratory at that point and not required to get into the study, and they were randomized to either carboplatin paclitaxel or gefitinib, and the primary endpoint was PFS in a non-inferiority fashion, which actually was slightly in favor of the gefitinib when you looked at that analysis. Survival has not been reported yet overall, but the very interesting subsets that came out were the EGFR mutation data that showed PFS and response to be superior for gefitinib. The second study that was published recently was a smaller study. They stopped early from Japan, which again was a similar population, but the point of it was every patient had to have an EGFR mutation. And so that was a more pure study. The primary endpoint was to see if there was benefit in patients with EGFR mutations. And in fact, they saw better PFS in that population, similar to the subset results of IPASS.
So Mark, in terms of practical decision-making in a patient like this where you know they have an EGFR mutation, are there any situations where you might go to chemo? For example, highly symptomatic patient, you need a quick response.
Well, no, if I know they have a mutation, the response rate's higher to erlotinib than it was to carboplatin-paclitaxel, although carboplatin-paclitaxel has a higher response rate in mutants compared to wild type, but the best response rates are with the EGFR TKI. So I think that's the best bet in here. It's kind of a no-brainer given the IPASS and the Japanese trial, and then we'll talk about the CLGB trial also.
John?
Yeah, so I'll take an unpopular position here and talk in defense of chemotherapy for patients with EGFR mutations, or at least making sure they get chemotherapy as part of their overall treatment. So one of the interesting and I think unexpected findings from IPASS was how well patients with EGFR mutations did with chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. So the response rate was roughly doubled. The response rate was about 47% in patients with EGFR mutations, and patients without EGFR mutations, the response rate to standard chemotherapy was about 23%. But in terms of things that I think would also be reasonable regimens, especially as Mark raised that you don't have the EGFR mutation data right away, if you look at the ATLAS and SATURN studies, so these were two studies using erlotinib in the maintenance setting, and the group that seems to most clearly benefit, not surprisingly, are those with EGFR mutations. So here, if you give first-line chemotherapy and then in non-progressors, you're adding erlotinib to that regimen. The hazard ratio for PFS was 0.11, if I remember correctly, in the EGFR mutation-positive group. So given the high response rates of these patients to chemotherapy and the fact that they clearly benefit in the maintenance setting of erlotinib, and as Tom raised before, the important thing is making sure they get erlotinib and they don't fall off at some point. Given all that, I also think it's a reasonable alternative to give upfront chemotherapy, especially while these diagnostic tests are being worked out, and then making sure they get erlotinib in the maintenance setting.
Yeah, I would agree with everything John said, and I think that oftentimes, you know, you have to start treatment. And I guess the question is, I've been asked, you know, let's say you give the first cycle, they come back for the second cycle, and now you know they have a mutation, what do you do? Well, I give 4 cycles. I pursue the SATURN approach,
right,
and I give 4 cycles, either with or without bevacizumab, and then add the erlotinib as maintenance, right, and I think those two trials validate that strategy.
Ed?
I think, you know, those of us who are involved with interest, this was not a surprise, because we showed that in our subset in Interest, which was docetaxel versus gefitinib.
And just briefly, the design of Interest?
So Interest was docetaxel versus gefitinib in all comers, second-line therapy, 1,466 patients. And the subset we looked at with EGFR mutations showed a doubling of the docetaxel response rate, as well as an overall survival that was comparable to gefitinib in EGFR mutation patients. And that was sort of where we started this, well, maybe it's more of a prognostic factor instead of actually predictive of a certain drug.
Well, on the other hand, there's also the toxicity issue comparing the two. In a second, I'm going to ask Roman if you can talk about the CALGB study, but Rogerio?
No, so I think what John said makes perfect sense. And I think we all have a lot of patients in our practice that were treated exactly like that. If you even look at the TRIBUTE subset analysis, which was sort of a pilot exploration of, you know, never smokers with chemo and TKI inhibitors, you know, there was that sense that they probably should not be given concomitantly, and many of those folks initially received chemo followed by the TKI. So the SATIN data sort of comes along with this. The only exception to this, however, is the CALGB data that we're going to talk about, in which it didn't seem to add for those EGFR positive patients. You know, chemo did not seem to make a significant difference, except that it was given concomitantly, not in a sequence. You know, so I think it's a great discussion how exactly to match the TKI with the chemo in these patients, and is there a role for chemo in these patients?
So let's talk about the CALGB study. It was great after, you know, having so much stuff come out outside the U.S. to have a U.S. cooperative group present data addressing this. Roman, what was the design of the study and what was their major findings?
So this was a study in never smokers or light smokers, randomized phase 2, comparing carboplatin and erlotinib against erlotinib alone. Carboplatin erlotinib, when analyzing the, I think, the TRIBUTE study, which was carboplatin alone and carboplatin plus erlotinib. I think it was Vince Miller who discovered, or the analysis showed, that the never smokers seem to be benefiting from adding erlotinib to chemotherapy, which has been the headache of the TKIs to put them with chemo. But it seemed that even concomitantly in that population, it seemed that adding erlotinib to carboplatin was going to provide the benefit. And I think the hypothesis was that chemo kills cells, and erlotinib in these patients also kills cells. So you basically put together two things that kill cells. Whereas in other populations, erlotinib may slow down the growth, and then that would interfere negatively with chemotherapy. So they did this study, and what they didn't do is have a chemotherapy-only arm. So we have a randomized phase 2 erlotinib alone against carboplatin erlotinib in a population that we know is enriched for EGFR mutation, therefore a population in which erlotinib has good effect. And I think I didn't know, that obviously, like most people, the results of the study before, but obviously the hope is, when we were studying oncology 2 decades ago, they were telling us principles of combination therapy. You take agents that work differently, they don't have overlapping toxicity, put them together, boom, you have a better regimen. So it seems that here the expectation would be that erlotinib is so different than chemo. And chemo works so well also in mutated patients that, and all the patients treated with erlotinib alone relapse, or most of them, then we don't seem to be curing people with erlotinib alone. So maybe by adding chemo we'll have something better. And I think the unfortunate result in a way of the study is that actually erlotinib is a solo player and does not seem to need the help of chemotherapy to do the job. In other words, the cells that erlotinib kills alone are probably not much different than the cells that chemo kills alone. But erlotinib is more effective, so it can kill more or a wider variety of cells within this population of never smokers.
So, Tom, what was your take from this study?
So, I mean, I think it just confirming some of the things we've been saying. I think the fact that EGFR mutations seem to predict who did better from both treatments was seemed to be the main take-home message, is that, and then this is what John just said earlier, is that not to discount the impact that chemotherapy had. I was a bit disappointed that we didn't see more activity for the combination approach, similar to what you might have seen in the TRIBUTE study. But again, the study was small, and it can't exclude that there may have been some benefit, but it certainly doesn't appear that there's going to be any additional benefit to doing that.
Ed?
So two questions. One is, as we talked about what the community physician is going to do in practice, and they have an EGFR mutation test that comes back in the middle of chemotherapy up front. We know that that patient who is eligible for a mutation is most likely eligible for bevacizumab. They usually are going to get pemetrexed because they're going to have an adenocarcinoma these days. So you're seeing in practice carboplatin, pemetrexed, sometimes with bevacizumab, and then after 4 or 6 cycles, they're going to go on to either bev maintenance or pem-bev maintenance. If you knew an EGFR mutation was present while you were finishing cycle 4 of carbo-pem or carbo-pem-bev, would you think that that information would incline a physician in the community to take a patient off PEM and BEV and start erlotinib?
Great.
It's a tough question. You know, I think that those are questions that we deal with in the exam room with the patients all the time. And it really is a back and forth discussion with the patient and trying to understand the toxicities that they're experiencing. And, you know, one of the toxicities of chemotherapy is going to see the doctor every 4 weeks or every 3 weeks and sitting in that chair for an hour or so. And so we have to remember that as the toxicity. And as we all know, pemetrexed bevacizumab has a relatively low toxicity profile and in some ways is easier to take for some patients than erlotinib is. So it's a tough question to answer, and it certainly requires a conversation with the patient because we don't know. Biologically, we don't know, and from clinical trial data, we don't know what the right answer is.
John?
Well, as Roman raised, we think conceptually about combining a drug like an EGFR inhibitor in chemotherapy, and it makes a lot of sense, but the results have been disappointing so far. But I also want to raise the point that we don't want to discount out of hand the possibility that this specific chemotherapy may make a difference. And in particular, if we think about combinations of pemetrexed and EGFR inhibitors, mechanistically, and there's preclinical data out there now about this, it turns out that thymidylate synthase, an enzyme that we think is involved in determining the sensitivity to pemetrexed, is actually regulated by EGFR via the C2F1 pathway. And so in preclinical models, at least, there's synergy between pemetrexed or other things that target thymidylate synthase and EGFR inhibitors. So it may be the case that even if CALGB's results with concomitant therapy with chemotherapy and EGFR inhibitors were disappointing, that with the right chemotherapy combination, we may be able to achieve additional benefit with the two together.
Rogerio?
I just want to go back to Ed's case because I think this is a scenario that a lot of people face in clinical practice. And even though we obviously don't do the same thing for every single patient in the situation, just to try to take this a step further, I probably would discontinue the chemo after 4 cycles. And I would put that patient on erlotinib. The question is, should I continue the bevacizumab, you know, with the erlotinib? And I've done it both ways. You know, I've done with or without the bev, depending on how they handle the bev and sort of benefit they experience during the chemo and the bev. And I have patients that have tumors mutated for EGFR on erlotinib and bev for now 18 months or longer. So I think I would take that approach instead of maintenance chemo as opposed to the EGFR.
So we're going to move to the next question. We've talked about the rationale to use an EGFR TKI like erlotinib in patients with mutations, but then what happens when they develop progression or if they develop progression? And actually, this woman that Greg presented entered a clinical trial attempting to, I think, sort of address that question. Why don't you bring us up to date on this lady?
Sure. So you recall she had a pleural effusion that was treated by pleuridesis and then was found to have an EGFR mutation. And as we thought about her initial treatment options, I gave her the option of erlotinib or enrollment in a clinical trial. And she looked at everything and took a look at the consent for the clinical trial and elected to pursue the clinical trial. And this clinical trial was a phase 2 trial of the drug called BIBW2992, which is a next generation EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitor. It's irreversible binding to the epidermal growth factor receptor, and the hope is that it has greater activity against particular resistance mutations and would hopefully do better than erlotinib. This was a non-randomized study that she was in, so it was a phase 2 trial just to get an initial sense of the activity of this drug in that setting.
And where is she right now?
She's now 19 months into treatment with BIBW2992 and doing well.
19 months, what happened to her tumor?
So she had largely pleural-based disease, and that has all gone away, essentially a near CR. She has no pleural effusion. She has no parenchymal lesions visible on CT and no lymph nodes.
What about side effects and tolerability with the drug?
So she initially began treatment with BIBW-2982 at 50 milligrams, and she had a relatively significant problem with diarrhea and a significant problem with paronychia around the nail beds. After 2 months on treatment, she was dose reduced to 40 milligrams, and she's been on 40 milligrams since that time, and she's done relatively well with that. She continues to have some acne-like rash, and she has occasional episodes of diarrhea, but it's all quite tolerable for her.
Her energy level / fatigue?
She has none.
So, Tom, what do you say to patients who've gotten, and more typically would be erlotinib, like this woman had a good response, they're now 18 months doing well, if they say, is there any chance I'm cured? What should I expect from the future, Dr. Lynch?
So I think it's two great questions. I think that there are patients who are long-term survivors who have not progressed. Greg's boss, Mark Chris, has several of them. I have two. So those of us, Mark and Ruggiero, Roman, you might have some left
over. Still on treatment?
Still on treatment, left over from the early 2000s.
But these are people who have been treated for years.
For years. And so the first question is, can you stop treatment? And I don't think any of us have the guts to stop treatment in this setting. And we don't stop treatment in CML. If you think about it, we don't stop treatment in CML. And if you're not going to stop it in CML,
where they have a molecular response,
you certainly aren't going to stop treatment here.
And we know why we don't stop it in CML.
Yeah,
actually, they have
reason,
the data.
For good reason. And I think that we feel that's probably similar here. But I also don't want to oversell the likelihood of that happening. If you look at the denominator of cases that Mark Chris and I and Mark and Ruggiero have treated, you're talking about a couple thousand patients to get a handful of long-term survivors. So I think the more common situation is that you're going to have progression somewhere in the 12 to 36-month range after being on it. And there's even some early progressors who progress to 6 to 12 months. I think, Greg, one of the most exciting things that's come out of Memorial Sloan Kettering recently has been the data that you guys have with BIBW-2992 and cetuximab. And the data for BIBW-2992 plus cetuximab in people who harbor the T790M mutation. I know that your colleague Vince Miller is leading a study that we're participating in as well, looking at these people who acquire the T790M secondary mutation. Looks very exciting preclinically.
So hold on. Let's go back a second. Tom is involved. I think you were the only one here involved with the project we did at ISLEC, the Atlas of Molecular Oncology. And the whole purpose was to try to make molecular oncology understandable to people like me, because all I know is upstream and downstream. So I'm going to go to John for a little primer on mechanisms of resistance to TKIs and what is the T790M.
Sure. So the way that tyrosine kinase inhibitors work, or I guess first to talk about the way that kinases work. So a kinase is an enzyme that phosphorylates another protein, and this is a key way that signaling happens, is a kinase phosphorylates other proteins and signaling cascades start from there. And the way that the kinase works is it takes an ATP, so of course ATP is the basic, building block and used for energy throughout the cell, and it takes the third phosphate there and it transfers it over. That's the enzyme's activity, is transferring this phosphate group. Kinase inhibitors are ATP mimetics, so they're shaped, they have two rings the way that ATP has two rings usually, and they fit in the same pocket that the ATP molecule does within the kinase, so they mimic the activity of that. Now, the reason that a cell doesn't shut down whenever you use an ATP mimetic is because the area around the ATP, the pocket that it fits in, is different between the different kinases. So it's really quite a feat of chemistry that companies and others are able to design inhibitors that specifically inhibit one ATP pocket but not the other because they're so similar. So drugs like erlotinib and gefitinib, of course, fit into the ATP pocket of EGFR but not other kinases. Now, we learned from early experience with BCR-ABL that over time, kinases can become resistant to kinase inhibitors through gatekeeper mutations. And there's a specific one that happens with BCR-ABL that prevents imatinib and other drugs from binding into that. So that mutation, I believe it's a 315 mutation in BCR-ABL. And it turns out, unfortunately, that the analogous mutation happens in lung cancer. And so that's a T790M. So it means that the threonine at the 790 position of the EGFR protein is substituted for methionine.
What's been explained to me, actually by your colleague, Dr. Gandharjan, is that this is sort of a natural selection kind of phenomena that occurs. That's what they think in CML. Is that what happens in lung cancer?
Right. Well, it's a great question. Is it induced by treatment or are they existing at a low frequency and they're just selected for? And then there's data in lung cancer that they are present at a very low frequency. And when you kill off the ones that don't have a T790M, they're the ones that are remaining. Interestingly, in fact, the group from MGH identified a family that it had inherited a T790M mutation, and that mutation by itself is mildly activating, and that it was actually a family predisposed to lung cancer. So we do see occasionally, and I've probably had three or four in my practice, of people who have a T790M and an EGFR mutation at the beginning of treatment, but it's a very, very small minority of patients. So what happens when the T790M mutation is present or increases in frequency is that gefitinib and erlotinib no longer fit into this ATP pocket. It creates a hindrance and it changes the kinetics for ATP versus gefitinib and erlotinib from binding, so they're no longer effective.
Could I just ask, Tom, do you agree with that? Because I know there's been some controversy about what really is going on. What actually happens in terms of the T790 mutation and why it creates resistance, that it doesn't fit?
I think the feeling that I feel is probably emerged as being more likely is it has to do with competition for the ATP binding, and that it's not necessarily as more steric hindrance, but it's more of competition for ATP binding. But I think it still remains somewhat of an open question.
Yeah, and what you can say in this data from Passiani and others, that ATP binds more tightly when you have a T790M. So that's certainly one thing that happens, and gefitinib and erlotinib flop in and out more quickly. But there's also another study that shows the binding velocity goes down, so how quickly these molecules can fit into the pocket. So I think there's likely to be contributions of both steric hindrance and ATP kinetics.
Now, this BIBW compound that this woman received, you hear about it being, quote, a non-competitive inhibitor. Is that the case, and how much difference does it make?
Yeah, so it has a different mechanism than the typical inhibitors we think of, the quinazoline inhibitors, in that it forms a covalent bond with a cysteine that's in the pocket. So it associates, actually, it doesn't fit in the ATP pocket the same way, and that's why it's called a non-competitive inhibitor. And then once it forms this covalent bond, it isn't coming out. So it inhibits wild-type EGFR as well as mutant EGFR and has a little different kinetics, but the key point is that it is able to inhibit this gatekeeper mutation, the T790M mutation, whereas gefitinib and erlotinib are not able to do that at clinically achievable concentrations. So in the lab, when you're dealing with cell lines, for example, if you go above 3 or 5 micromolar of gefitinib and erlotinib, you're not able to inhibit cells that have a T790M mutation, but you can inhibit them with the irreversible inhibitors like BIBW2992. And when you talk about clinically achievable concentrations, it's closer to the order of 1 micromolar or so in patients.
So, Tom, any other comments on mechanisms of resistance and new agents to overcome resistance?
So the difficult thing we're having is that I think many of the drugs that look promising in the EGFR axis are going to turn out to be better first-line drugs than erlotinib or gefitinib. I'm not certain, except for the trial that we're doing based on the work of Memorial, that we've really come up with anything that, as of yet, is able to overcome patients who have resistance. And I think one of the things that's interesting, a number of us put together a paper this past year that was published in Clinical Cancer Research that defines this concept of what is resistance to primary EGFR inhibitors. And we know there's this retreatment phenomena. And I think what worries me is many of the responses that we've seen with either chloroquine or BIBW or the Pfizer drug in the refractory setting may really be retreatment responses.
And it's so what you're saying is somebody can get erlotinib or gefitinib, respond, and then what?
Then progress, come back 6 months later, put them back in erlotinib, you can see a response.
But being off the drug, obviously.
Being off the drug.
So you go off the drug and you put them back on it and they respond.
And they can respond again. And it's not common, but it's not clear that we really have shown yet that we have drugs that have the ability to overcome resistance to TKIs, either T790M or MET amplification, or the as of yet unknown 30% resistance.
Rogerio?
I was just going to ask this question to the panel, which is, I mean, do you envision this new generation of drugs to be primarily used instead of erlotinib and gefitinib as better drugs in that setting, or more for secondary resistance? Because taking from CML, you know, used to be imatinib, and then the second generation drugs were used after relapse or resistance to imatinib. And now there's recent data indicating that they may be better than imatinib, you know, even as first-line therapy. So is this same thing going to happen in lung cancer?
But there clearly were responses in people progressing on imatinib. And I think with Tom, I'm not sure.
There were responses, but what I'm saying is I'm not certain that those responses are necessarily due to the better second drug, or you would have seen those responses with erlotinib alone. But to get to your point, I think yes. I think the BIBW compound and I think the Pfizer compound may turn out to be better erlotinib than erlotinib.
Ed?
So we bring up the T790 resistance aspect. Are we convinced after ASCO that this is a bad thing now? Because we actually saw some data that, in fact, if you had a T790, your survival was better than if you didn't have the presence of it and you were failing TKI.
Great.
I think that the phenomena of acquired resistance, you know, so erlotinib has stopped working, that's clearly a bad thing. And if you develop resistance by a mechanism with a secondary mutation, T790M, it might be a better kind of acquired resistance, but it's still acquired resistance and your cancer is still growing at that point. So it's either way, it's a bad thing.
John?
Yeah, conceptually, a way that I at least think about that observation, T790M by itself is weakly activating. It isn't as strongly activating as an exon 19 or an L858R mutation, the classic sensitizing EGFR mutations. And certainly when we do proteomic and gene expression analyses on it, the cells are EGFR dependent with the T790M. So the fact that EGFR mutant patients have slower growing tumor, mitosis is reduced, they're better differentiated, they're better prognostically. I think that's what we're seeing, that patients with T790Ms, it may be a better prognostic marker, but we do know it's associated with resistance to EGFR TKIs that we're currently using. And so I agree with the point that ultimately I think we're going to be replacing erlotinib or using these irreversible inhibitors as long as they have comparable or better activity against wild-type EGFR as well as the mutants. I think they'll end up replacing it, and that T790M is a small percentage and it doesn't explain the differences that were observed, for example, with the Pfizer compound.
Roman, let's take this discussion on EGFR TKIs to the next level, and I want you to present your 58-year-old patient.
So to go very brief, classical patient that is being referred after he's been started chemo in another place, stage 4, never smoker. In another hospital, they start carboplatin bev, his adeno. After the second cycle, the EGFR testing comes up, and it's mutated. And I then get another PET-CT, and I get the old PET-CT, and basically no change. So lack of response to carboplatin bev. So I decide, because he's mutant, to start erlotinib. He's a dark-skinned guy from Dominican Republic. And I see him, I start 150, and he comes over. And definitely this guy, if you look close, because when they have dark skin, it's more difficult to see the rash, the purple. He has a very impressive rash in the face, in the scalp, chest, in the back.
Symptomatic?
It's symptomatic with some paronychia eventually, but the guy is a non-complainer. So the question for you guys is, in an EGFR mutant, how strong you feel about the 150 and how easy you would go down feeling comfortable that this guy doesn't need 150? The guy is willing to continue 150, but I'm seeing this and I see that this is a picture. I mean, this is what we see, you know, in the presentations when they show you the rash. So the thing was, is it okay or you feel comfortable by giving 100 or being less, if you want, rigorous on trying to keep the 150. And it's basically the question of the dose intensity in the mutated patient.
And what's going on with the tumor?
The tumor has responded beautifully after we started erlotinib. He's responded beautifully. He didn't respond to carboplatin bev.
Ruggieri?
So I would dose reduce. Yeah, I wouldn't have any.
How far down would you go?
Major issues.
First.
To as low as it's comfortable for him.
Okay.
So I've treated patients, you know, 100 would be the next step. Mm-hmm. And then if I have to go 75 and then 50 and... Usually, I try to keep people at 50, but I've had a few patients on 25.
Have there been clinical trial
especially
reports?
Especially the mutant patients. Well, there's an Asian trial.
There was a recent one with EGFR mutants where they responded, I think it was to 25 or 50.
Right. 25 was right. Equivalent to the higher doses.
And they were responding still to it.
And yes. What I know has not been done is analyze the rash and survival in the mutated patients. Mm. I haven't seen anything or anybody haven't done that, which probably would help. Because you would think that there shouldn't be a relationship if the dose is not important.
So let's try to get through the EGFR story. Greg, can you talk about the two papers? Maybe you can start with the second one, actually.
Sure. So the second paper is the ASCO abstract by James Yang and colleagues. It's the LUX-Lung2, which is, it's actually the clinical trial that the patient we described is on. It's a phase 2 trial looking at patients with lung adenocarcinoma with known activating mutations. I think that this is the population of patients that we now know from IPASS is the one that's going to benefit from erlotinib, and they're going to have a better response to EGFR-directed approach than they would with chemotherapy. This trial saw that future and was designed several years ago, and it explores this new drug, BIBW-2992. And as we mentioned previously, the hope is that the BIBW drug is an irreversible inhibitor and will work better than erlotinib in this setting at hopefully treating any resistance that is there at baseline and preventing the development of acquired resistance for a longer period of time. And so this trial was largely conducted in Asia, though there are some sites in the U.S. where patients were treated. The primary endpoint of the clinical trial was objective response rate because we wanted to get a sense of whether this drug works in this setting or compare it a little bit to what's currently out there. Patients were treated with 50 milligrams initially with BIBW-2992, but they realized that that was a relatively toxic dose and the same toxicities that we see in erlotinib-treated patients, but are just a bit more severe, and they decreased the dose to 40 milligrams. And what they saw was that the response rate was a very respectable, about 60% for all patients with EGFR-activating mutations. And then when you look at the classic EGFR LA58R, EGFR exon 19 deletion, there was again a 60% response rate. It doesn't seem to be a major difference in response rate or progression-free survival for EGFR LA58R or exon 19 deletions when you compare the two. And the progression-free survivals that were reported here are on the order of what we see with erlotinib, though somewhat better, I have to say. The progression-free survival for EGFR LA58R patients was 16 months, and for exon 19 deletion patients was 14 months. And we compare that to what we know for gefitinib, it's closer to 12 to 13 months, though it's really hard to compare across trials, and I wouldn't try to do that.
We have some beautiful waterfall plots here, too.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. We're almost getting used to these now, where if you have a molecular targeted agent and a molecular target, and you give it to the right patient, you see these waterfall plots that show almost every tumor shrinks a little bit. We've seen it now with gefitinib. We've seen it with crizotinib. In the melanoma world, we've seen it with the Plexxikon drug. It really is validation of the concept that if you have a molecular target and you have the right drug, you're going to get patients' tumors to shrink.
I think the one thing I was struck by in this paper is they included some other mutations, and the other mutations didn't do well. And I think when you look at response rates, be careful about saying, well, the response rate here was only 58% versus 70% with other drugs. And I think it's because a lot of it depends upon the mix of your mutation types.
What kind of other mutations?
Exon 20 mutations.
Ah.
So exon 20 mutations aren't incredibly rare. I see a couple every couple of months, and we know that there are some patients who respond, but we also know that a number of resistance mutations are exon 20 mutations, so it's something to keep your eye on.
Greg, what about the paper by Oxnard looking at the clinical course of patients with acquired resistance to EGFR TKIs?
So this paper is from our group, and what we did here is we took a look at our experience with rebiopsy. So since we've understood the role of EGFR mutations in predicting response to erlotinib and gefitinib, we've been trying to understand the ensuing development of acquired resistance, and we've been trying to biopsy as many patients as possible, and we've done this as part of a clinical trial. And this abstract looks at about 120 patients initially, and then we kind of take out a few extras, and we're down with 93 patients. And we decided to look at some of their clinical characteristics and look at the frequency of the most common mechanism of acquired resistance, that is the EGFR T790M. And I think probably the first point I would mention from this abstract is that 62% of people in this data set had EGFR T790M. This, you know, we're sort of increasing the frequency of that mutation identified in acquired resistance as we get better at testing for it. And so that really does represent a strong proportion of those patients. And that certainly serves as a target for development of drugs in that setting. But when we looked at the outcomes of those patients with an EGFR T790M and compared it to patients who have other mechanisms of acquired resistance, in this case, really unknown mechanisms of acquired resistance, it seems as those patients who have T790M did a little bit better, both in terms of their overall survival from starting drug as well as their survival from development of progression. You know, statistically, it's kind of odd to think about the outcomes of a patient who develops a type of resistance because they develop that type of resistance in the middle of it. So it's probably not a statistically pure comparison, but it definitely seems like those patients with T790M do better than those patients without T790M, or I guess really unknown mechanisms of acquired resistance.
So just practical point for a physician in the community, Tom, you have a patient who's had a great response to erlotinib for a couple of years, and then they develop progressive disease. Any exciting trials or options out there that are, you know, encouraging enough that a doc in practice ought to think about sending somebody somewhere?
As I said earlier, I think the trial that Vince is leading at Memorial of cetuximab plus BIBW2992 is, I think, the most exciting trial out there in that setting.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Because you guys have reported on or talked about cetuximab and erlotinib, I think, but I didn't know about cetuximab and BIBW.
Right. So as I mentioned in this abstract, we noticed that about 60% of people have EGFR T790M. And as John alluded to earlier, what that really tells us is that these tumors remain dependent on EGFR signaling for their existence. And so EGFR is still the target here. It's just a matter of inhibiting it appropriately. We would like to think that BIBW2982 is the answer for that by itself, but we don't know that that's the case. And some mouse modeling data suggests that it doesn't really shrink tumors with a T790M. So if you think about ways to target EGFR, we all know about cetuximab and panitumumab, these antibodies that block EGFR, and they bind to the extracellular surface, so it's really a complementary mechanism of EGFR inhibition. And so the thought is to try to combine a kinase inhibitor with an antibody to try to really block EGFR.
I'm trying to think about the studies of cetuximab in lung cancer. I mean, Tom, you did one. Do we know anything about just the response rate to chemocetuximab in mutation patients?
No, but mutations are not supposed to be predictive of response to cetuximab, correct?
No, EGFR mutations don't. We had a paper last year, 1% response rate, 2% response rate, either in mutations or in non-mutations. There's something going on here that is different. And now the question is, Katie Politi is the person who did, along with William Pao, did the mouse modeling. Maybe the mouse model is completely unpredictive of what happens in patients. But in the mouse model of a T790M mutated mouse, they were able to see complete eradication of tumor by combining cetuximab with 2992. I keep an open mind and hope like heck it happens in patients.
No, and I think that it's really exciting data that's led to this trial, but it's important to point out in that same model that showed that when you combine erlotinib with cetuximab, you don't see that effect. And so, and we did a clinical trial adding cetuximab to erlotinib, and we did not see significant tumor shrinkage. So the mouse model bore out in that sense. And so hopefully it will bear out in adding BIBW2992 to cetuximab, and we should actually see responses.
So back to my translational professor, John. So can you explain why BIBW plus cetuximab might be more effective than erlotinib plus cetuximab?
So I haven't heard a mechanism that would explain that necessarily. Now, I think the first question is why cetuximab works. And, you know, we and you heard about the mouse modeling work from William Powell's group and others have also seen in mouse models, cetuximab is actually doing something different than EGFR inhibitor. It looks like its main effect may be from downregulating the receptor from the cell surface. So instead of inhibiting the kinase activity, you may actually be having it come off the cell surface and shutting down its activity that way. So when you look at the total amount of protein on the cell surface that can be signaling, with cetuximab, it actually goes down a bit. So maybe that the combination of BIBW, where you get an irreversible inhibition, and cetuximab, you're actually downregulating the receptor and you're covalently linking it, so you're shutting down its activity. So it's potentially a more permanent shutdown than adding an irreversible inhibitor like erlotinib in there.
Mark?
Can you give us some sense of what happened to these patients? Because I think in clinical practice, you know, we're all seeing, and I'm sure the community docs are seeing, you know, is the more mutation testing you're doing, you're identifying these sensitivity mutations. Erlotinib is a pretty good drug, and you can get a year or two, but then they start to slowly progress. And what do you do? Not everyone's coming to your place for that clinical trial. What do you practically do in the community for those patients? And what happened with these patients here in terms of subsequent therapies?
I think that's a critically important issue to raise. I'm glad you brought it up. So in this abstract by Oxnard, where we describe this better outcome for patients with T790M, these patients are treated at Memorial Sloan Kettering in the way we treat patients. And we treat patients with EGFR mutations, initially with erlotinib. And then at the time of progressive disease on erlotinib, we look for a clinical trial that they may be eligible for. But if that's not available, we generally continue erlotinib and we'll add some sort of conventional chemotherapy. So these patients are all maintained on erlotinib despite resistance to erlotinib. So that's a critically important issue to point out.
What's your thinking in doing that?
So when, you know, we've done some small studies, when I say small, I mean really small, 10 patients, where we've taken patients who respond to erlotinib and then develop resistance. And then we did some scans, stopped the drug, repeated those scans, and we saw the tumors grow, as you'd expect, because they were resistant in the first place. But then we restarted the drug on those patients, and we saw the tumors either stabilize or in some cases shrink after just a few weeks off of drug. And so the thought is that some portion of the tumor remains sensitive to erlotinib, and as such, erlotinib may be giving these patients some benefit.
Roman?
I believe in the intermittent or reinduction because I think it makes sense to say that if a patient is on erlotinib constantly, then you get these resistant clones coming. You stop, and these clones are less virulent. So the more virulent sensitive may take over. You wait 2-3 months, and that clone takes over. You hit again with erlotinib, and I've seen some reinductions of response. And I think that's the explanation, probably.
But do they keep erlotinib going and a patient progressing on erlotinib and add
chemo? If the progression is very slowly, no new lesions, I would do that. If I see new lesions, I may stop and try something else. But I have also stopped and restarted after 2-3 months and seen some, not PRs, but maybe minor responses.
I just want to note for the oncologist on the Rose of America, the skeptical look in Ed Kim's face.
So, you know, I don't do it typically with erlotinib. I agree with the concept. The concept in that lung cancers are heterogeneous and you might have someone who progresses with new disease in the liver, but their chest disease is stable. That concept is what Greg is referring to, is that you've got some stability going on in one sort of cohort and then a new cohort of cells improves. I think it's very important for the community oncologist to take all of this with a grain of salt at this point, because these are, we're trying to nuance observations. I mean, this is all we do, is we see hundreds of lung cancer patients. And so, you know, when we have that type of denominator, it's easier for us to make some associations and do that. I think, you know, if you want to be on the other side of devil's advocate, there's more data with doublet second-line chemotherapy out there right now that has been published recently, and I would not recommend that we do that at this point. But, you know, again, because of side effects, et cetera. But, you know, I think these are important concepts. I think they should be studied. I think studying something like combination data like that is very good, but I'd be very cautious on doing that.
So it sounds like you don't do that. Rogerio, do you do it or not?
I do it sometimes. In EGFR mutated patients, I will sometimes keep them on the TKI inhibition and add a conventional chemo.
Tom, patients progressing on erlotinib, do you ever keep it going on chemo?
I do, and the reason I do it is similar to what Greg is saying, is if you look at autopsies that were done as part of the paper that defined c-MET resistance, Jeff Engelman's work, they biopsied patients in Japan who were EGFR mutant and found that some areas of tumor that they biopsied did not have the resistance mutation. Others had T790M, others had c-MET, arguing that there can be heterogeneity in different tumors in the body. And so you may decide to keep the erlotinib going to treat those tumors that have not developed resistance, add in pemetrexed or vonorelbine or gemcitabine or whatever you're going to add chemotherapy-wise to treat the tumors that have become resistant at that point. But I think it's not crazy.
Well, I don't disagree with that, but I think, you know, a plausible other way to look at this is the fact, as Roman said, that these cells that are progressing, or the clones that are progressing, may actually be the clones in which there may be antagonism between chemo and EGFR inhibition. I mean, we don't know that.
And
it might be better served with, because what I most commonly do is, first of all, I try to keep people on erlotinib as long as I can. I tolerate slow progression for as long as I can. Then I tend to take them off of it, treat them with chemo, and then put them back on it after 4 or 6 cycles, whatever I'm going to do. That's typically what I've done. I mean, that may be right or wrong. I don't know. But like someone said, it's a testable hypothesis.
I mean, is this worth a clinical trial? Or
it comes up in clinical practice a lot as a question, at least to me. Like, what do you do?
There is an ongoing clinical trial. I don't know that it's necessarily accruing very well, led by Balazs Halmos, where at the time of resistance, he's randomizing patients to pemetrexed or pemetrexed and erlotinib. So these are patients who were on erlotinib before, and this is really testing that question. I hope the trial is completed.
In mutated patients only?
No,
or
I remember
everybody?
That's not necessarily mutated patients.
It's not necessarily mutated. Yeah. It's patients who've been on erlotinib for, I believe, it's 3 to 6 months, something like that.
So, you know, for years, oncologists would continue trastuzumab and change the chemo in metastatic breast cancer. And all the other investigators and tumor types say, why do they do that? There's no randomized trial. They tried to do the randomized trial. They couldn't do it. Finally, they did the randomized trial, and it worked. So, Ed, I guess there is some precedence for this kind of strategy, although it hasn't been looked at in lung cancer.
Yeah, and I think with the trastuzumab example, it more applies to bevacizumab in that, you know, you're looking at something that goes well with other chemotherapies. We know TKIs and chemotherapy are not exactly, you know, match made in heaven. I also think it's very difficult to test what we're talking about in practice at Marcus and others, in that we're looking at a patient. I mean, I had a patient who started, she didn't have a mutation. I started her on erlotinib. It were peripheral tumors against her chest wall. I followed these things growing slowly for 3 years before I finally switched her to chemotherapy. And I will bring her back onto erlotinib because the chemo has now shrunk, done its job. She's getting tired. She's got a break now. I think there are so many factors to consider. If we can find a marker that tells us when the switch occurs, the molecular change, that's one thing. But I think it's a combination of, okay, it grew, you know, 5% this time. The patient looks great. Their PS is zero. They're having no symptoms. If you go back and actually look at where their nadir was and how much they've progressed, you could scare yourself because the patient that I'm talking about probably grew close to 100%. But asymptomatic, feeling well, and it was not a tumor that was going to put her in any danger anytime soon.
So, Rogerio, you had a patient in your practice you wanted to kind of run by the group. Why don't you present her?
So this is an 80-year-old female African-American, never smoker, had a past medical history significant for just mild hypertension. She came in with a persistent, and it's an interesting symptom, and progressive pain in the right side of her face. You know, really the right side of the calvarium. And at the same time was feeling tired, lost her appetite, had lost a few pounds, et cetera, eventually came to medical attention and had an MRI, which showed that she had a soft tissue density and irregular enhancement of the frontotemporal calvarium. So this was a bone lesion primary. The soft tissue density extended a little bit intracranially. The bone scan confirmed uptake in that location, plus another focus in the right iliac wing and left sacrum. CT of the chest showed a mass in the right upper lobe and a few hypodensities within the liver, very suspicious for metastatic disease. She, even before we saw her, she saw a pulmonologist who did a bronchoscopy and a transbronchial biopsy was positive for an adenocarcinoma, TTF1 positive. So that's when we met her. We offered her participation in CLGB 30406, the erlotinib versus erlotinib chemo that we discussed here earlier today. And she was randomized to erlotinib alone. Her tissue, by the way, was submitted to CALGB as part of the trial. As you saw in that study, they were able to obtain tissue in 90%+ of the patients.
Did you ever get back a mutation study on her?
We were not privy to that information. It's a problem for me now because the tissue was exhausted and we only had what was submitted to CLGB. And despite our request to break the code and obtain that information, I have been unsuccessful. But so she had a clinical and an objective response to erlotinib. She was also treated with bifosphonates. She required 2 dose reductions because of a skin rash, eventually was maintained on 75. And her response lasted for 12 months. When she progressed within the liver.
Incidentally, Tom, does she have a mutation?
She may well. I mean, it sounds to me like she probably does, based on the response rate we saw from IPASS and the EGFR mutants. I mean, EGFR wild type was only 1%, so...
Mm. And progression-free survival of 12 months.
It was just about what
sounds like an EGFR mutant.
Yeah. It's behaving plus, like a mutant.
Plus, we now have the CLGB data. I mean, on the erlotinib arm, the response rate in the wild type was 3%, I think, and in the...
Well, maybe she was the one.
That's right. She was actually one of the studies.
She was on the studies.
So when she progressed, I tried to get this information because of the discussion we had about continuing the erlotinib and just adding something else or discontinuing the drug. I didn't get that information, so I discontinued the drug. And I treated her with carboplatin pemetrexed for one cycle. Again, this is an 80-year-old lady, good performance status, no major, you know, comorbidities.
Did she have tumor symptoms at the time
really.
You treated
her? No, this was a radiographic progression.
But the liver, so...
Liver, significant enough for me to discontinue the treatment, yes. Interestingly, and to the point of our discussion here today, she had major problems with carboplatin pemetrexed. I don't know if she was somewhat used to the erlotinib and what she expected, but she came back, and this is a very soft-spoken lady from North Carolina, by the way, and very nice, you know, never really imposed, you know, on anybody. And she walked into the door and she said, "I'm not taking this stuff again," basically. And I said, "Okay, I'm going to drop the carboplatin and I'm going to use a single agent." It's what I felt was a reasonable compromise. And I gave her another cycle of pemetrexed. She did not respond. So then I decided to use a taxane. She had not seen a taxane. And in patients this age, I usually use docetaxel on a weekly schedule. You know, 80-year-old people and plus, I usually use the weekly schedule. And she's had four cycles of that. It had a minor response as far as the liver disease. Chest is the same. It's harder to evaluate the bone scan, except she has no new lesions. But after the four cycles, she came back complaining of pain in the right pelvis, exactly where that bone scan had lit up initially. So I stopped the docetaxel, at least for now, and sent her for palliative radiation, which is where she is.
How long has she been off erlotinib?
Okay, so now she got two cycles of pemetrexed and four cycles of weekly docetaxel. So probably a good 5 to 6 months.
I'd give her erlotinib.
You would put her back on erlotinib.
Give her erlotinib, okay. With or without vonorelbine. If you okay. wanted to give her chemotherapy, you'd give her some vonorelbine, but I'd definitely put her back on erlotinib as your
okay.
next step.
Would you consider Bev at some point? She's never seen it.
You could. I probably wouldn't, but you certainly could.
Okay.
What were the exact problems she had on the carbo-pem?
You said real fatigue.
Fatigue. You know,
but really, she just said, "I couldn't do anything." And then had a little bit of nausea, had constipation, just felt really poorly. And it wasn't just for the 4 or 5 days after the carbo-pemetrexed. She felt not well for the almost 2.5 weeks after the chemo. So to me, it was compelling enough that I didn't feel that I needed to keep her on a combination regimen at that point.
Greg, what would you be thinking?
I mean, I think, you know, down three lines of therapy, you're thinking in the data-free zone in general. And I think that restarting erlotinib is really the sort of easy thing to do. And I would try it on its own first, because I think you might get a response. And then you can buy yourself a little while before you add in another chemo. That's sort of how I approach
it. Plus, we did a trial of docetaxel plus erlotinib in the elderly specifically. And then I think there is some vonorelbine or erlotinib Italian data in the elderly that was very toxic. Mm-hmm. And if this lady is kind of prone to chemotoxicities, I think I would be a little...
That was oral vonorelbine.
Oral vonorelbine, okay.
Killed people.
Yeah. I knew there was something about that.
We actually did a gefitinib vonorelbine study that was actually very toxic as well. Surprising myelosuppression.
So of all the chemos, vonorelbine or the vinca alkaloid seem to be the trouble when you combine them with TKIs for unclear
reasons. This is what I brought up earlier today was the, you know, when we talked about, you know, adding chemotherapy to these TKIs, it's not inconsequential from that standpoint.
No.
But are you abandoning docetaxel now, Rogerio? I mean, is this...
You know, so it's a good question, too, because she didn't have an objective progression. She just...
Is she tolerating
it? She
did
okay with the weekly docetaxel, and she felt well. You know, she was not feeling well after she finished the two cycles of pemetrexed. And, you know, she felt well, no disease-related symptoms, gained some weight. I mean, she was doing well on weekly docetaxel, had four full cycles.
So my take is that if you think she can take more of that, I've been off study combining it with cetuximab. Mm-hmm. Now, we're not going to get that data in second line till later this year, but, you know, I found that to be an active regimen together. I know she's from North Carolina.
But she's from North Carolina, so be careful.
You'll know very quickly. I mean, you know, those steroids might pick her up a little bit afterwards. But then I think if she's tolerating the docetaxel very well and you wanted to sort of do that, I've combined the two and then I've given maintenance cetuximab afterwards in people who have responded. And it's been usually third line or beyond. Now, not in an 80-year-old from North Carolina, but... You know, mm-hmm. I've had some experience with that.
Okay,
the next data set I want your take on is the Canadian study reported at ASCO in adjuvant erlotinib. Ed, can you go through that?
I'll try to remain very unbiased about this. So I think to caveat, this is the phase 3, and you see the title of the trial was a phase 3 randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial of epidermal growth factor receptor inhibitor gefitinib in completely resected stage 1B through 3A non-small cell lung cancer, and this was BR19. NCI Canada has had a great run of trials that they've been able to complete and report very important data. I think there needs to be almost a parenthesis after that and say this is not a completed study. Because when you read the title, you have high expectations. When you actually see what happened, not to the investigator's fault whatsoever, but just how the trial accrued, how it was conducted, and how it's reported, I think it, again, adds more confusion in this space that is very important. So this was a study of good intention from the very beginning to look at the addition of giving gefitinib for 2 years after resection of lung cancer, and that was stage 1B through 3A. This was developed before the era of adjuvant chemotherapy, and so the trial did have to be amended to include that later. And it was placebo versus gefitinib. They wanted to look at overall survival. And I think the intention of a trial like this was great. The fact is that as with every gefitinib study that occurred during the mid-2000s, it got interrupted because gefitinib was restricted off the market, and so it halted a lot of studies. So the problem is that you can have whatever statistical plan you want in this study, but the fact is that it's an incomplete study. And so the results, I think, have to be taken with a grain of salt. What it turned out to be was about 500 patients who were enrolled. Again, it had to be halted, 503 patients. Everyone was taken off study medication because there was no assessment for benefit. You didn't know if tumors were shrinking. It wasn't like patients who were treated in the advanced setting. This was a predominantly adenocarcinoma enrolled population. So 60% of patients had adenocarcinoma, 28% had squamous. There were only 8% never smokers, which is kind of odd since it was a Canadian study. And again, you know, smoking status didn't really change very much over this time. But I found that to be kind of interesting from that standpoint. Clearly, the survival did not show any difference. And again, the data has to be looked at a little bit more cautiously. The median time to treatment was only about 4 months of therapy. Anyone who got one pill was included in the analysis. And so that's a little bit misleading. They reported on exploratory biomarkers, and this is where they sort of tried to captivate everybody with the abstract. And if you want a good example of how to write an abstract to get on the oral session, this is a perfect example, because they reported two of the mutations in the abstract, but then they waited on the third and probably the most relevant one, which was EGFR mutation. So there were 27% of folks who had a KRAS mutation, and 21% had an EGFR mutation. Again, this was predominantly an adenocarcinoma, but those numbers seemed a little bit high to me. Again, you could find numbers where they could relate.
But there were 76 patients with mutations.
Right, total. So we're not talking about, again, we're going now into a small little subset as we go down. What they showed was, again, a lot of hazard ratios that didn't look beneficial. There was actually even a hint that, in fact, there might be worse detriment in mutation-positive patients. But we have to keep in mind that this is, again, only 70-some-odd patients, and it is in a study that was really not controlled because the treatment had to be stopped right away. So I don't know how much this study, frankly, alters my opinion of anything. Even during the era where they had to change the criteria in the study to add chemotherapy, and remember, 2004 is when the BR10 study was presented, only 17% of patients ended up receiving chemo in this study. So I never saw an accrual timeline in this for the 500 patients, but I would think more than 17% would have to receive chemotherapy, especially in a 1B and above predominant enrolled study.
Just to clarify, though, would you say, based on your looking at the data and what you heard, that there was no impact in terms of patients with mutations, or there was a negative impact?
I think the slant is that there may have been a trend toward negativity, and that's the story that's coming out. When I look at the data, to me, it's just a wash. It doesn't sway me in either direction. There would have to be a very profound difference, in my opinion, to make me think one way or the other.
Tom?
I agree with everything Ed said about this not being definitive. It's not definitive. It's just that the combination of this study plus 0023, two studies that we can't explain why the outcome looks worse, but the outcome certainly doesn't look better. And I think what it means is we need controlled trials to help us get through. That's what I would say. And I think all the criticisms that Ed has made of this are completely accurate. It's too small. They didn't get enough drug. 4 months of drug, but it definitely tempers my enthusiasm for the off-protocol setting. And Neil, that's a question you've asked of us almost every year for the past 5 or 6 years. And you got a lot of waffling, and many of us actually were doing it or recommending it or at least thinking about it off protocol. I think this has had a chilling effect on that.
I would say Tom and I actually agree, because my standard is I do not give anybody extra erlotinib or gefitinib if they have a mutation. Yeah. So to me, this doesn't change anything I'm doing.
I find that absolutely shocking. And, you know, I guess to say that the part to me that it really attacks is the following. The goal of adjuvant chemotherapy is to wipe out micrometastatic disease. Now, the way we selected the agents to test for adjuvant therapy up to this point, because it takes many years to do adjuvant trials, of course, is by picking the drugs that are most active in the metastatic setting. So the assumption is if you're the most active in the metastatic setting, you're going to be the most active in the adjuvant setting. Now, that isn't necessarily true. And in preclinical studies, you can see some things are more effective at preventing micrometastatic disease from progressing than it is for making advanced disease shrink. But this is what the study says here, is that we can't make the assumption that because something is highly active in the metastatic setting with macroscopic tumors that we can see, we can't just pick that as our candidate now for adjuvant and assume that it's going to work. Because, you know, don't forget the response rate here is 70 to 80% in the metastatic setting, you know, 2 to 3 times that of any chemotherapy. So to see this detriment is really shocking.
I think we have to wait for Radiant.
Has Radiant met accrual or not yet?
Yeah, Radiant's close to meeting.
Yeah. Remind us of the design and eligibility of Radiant.
Radiant, it's fairly similar to this design. It's resected. I assume it's 1B through 3A resected. You can give 4 cycles of chemotherapy. At the end of that, you're randomized to adjuvant erlotinib or placebo. And they presented some data on the tissue correlates at ASCO's last year. I mean, they have tissue on everybody, so they're going to have great surgical samples. And I think the mutation rate was a little bit lower than this, if I remember correctly, but there'll be 1,000 patients on the trial. So, you know, if the mutation rate's 15% or so, there'll be 150 or, you know, 180 mutant patients on that trial.
But aren't they using FISH or IHC to classify
for eligibility?
Eligibility. Yeah.
But they're testing for mutations.
I know that.
So that'll be the subset analysis. One point I wanted to mention from this, you know, this is, Ed's mentioned a lot of the flaws of this study, and I'm going to add one more. You know, in stage 4 clinical trials, we're always trying to get tissue so we understand what's going on with the patients. This is a trial of patients with resected lung cancer who every single one of them had a surgery to take out their tumor, but they only got 70% of the tumors to test for this. I don't think the data would change, but I think that if we're going to do clinical trials of adjuvant disease,
Isn't that similar to colorectal? Don't they get about that same rate?
Colorectal? I think that's about right. But we know that this tissue is available.
But the Radiant was much better.
Radiant is nearly 100%.
Yeah. At your institution, I mean, did this change the way you guys practice, or were you giving erlotinib in the adjuvant setting to mutated patients?
We were, and we continue to. It hasn't had quite the same chilling effect. But I personally have a little bit harder time with it. I think it's, you know, there's 2 pieces of data against it. There's nothing in the adjuvant setting to truly support it. So I have a little bit harder time with it. We're in the fortunate position of having a clinical trial that enrolls such patients. And so we put these patients on the clinical trials.
All right. I want to switch over into talking about some other issues in terms of advanced non-small cell. And I thought a good way to get into it would be to present, John, your case that we talked about before. Why don't you present her right up until the point where you had to make the decision about the first systemic therapy she got. We'll see what people do. We'll kind of work through the case at a couple different points.
Okay.
All right. Well, this is not an unusual case by any regard. It's a standard case of metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. This is a 60-year-old female who's a smoker. She presented with back pain, and she was found to have stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer, adenocarcinoma histology, widely metastatic or primarily in the bones with a couple of lung lesions.
How exactly did she present?
It was predominantly persistent back pain, and like a lot of other people, went to multiple chiropractors and sort of other types of treatment before somebody got an x-ray.
And how, vis-a-vis our discussion about tissue, how was the tissue accessed and how much was there?
So it was actually a lung nodule that was biopsied, and there was adequate tissue for initial mutation analyses, not for subsequent studies, which actually became relevant when we evaluated her for another study.
So anything else you want to say about her status at that point? And I want to ask Mark how he might think through the management of patient in the situation. Anything else you want to say about her presentation?
Yeah, because she had a relatively light smoking history and it was relatively well-differentiated adenocarcinoma, we did get EGFR and KRAS mutational testing right from the beginning. She did not have an EGFR mutation. She was wild type, but did have a KRAS mutation, a G12V mutation in KRAS.
So, Mark, how would you be thinking through the management of a patient like this?
Well, again, smoking history was former light.
It was light. It was current, but it was light. It was light. 20 to 30 pack years.
Yeah, so I would have done mutation testing. And like I said, we typically do KRAS and EGFR initially. I'm not sure why we do KRAS. I don't know how it should influence what you do. The reason we do it is we've got a couple of clinical trials in which your KRAS status needs to be defined. So that's really why we do it. If this patient didn't have a EGFR mutation, it was wild type, and if you were interested enough in her EGFR status, you should be as interested in her ALK status. So we would then proceed to do that. But from a therapeutic point of view, you know, the issue is looking at all the usual things we've looked at for a decade is, you know, what's the best chemotherapy option for her? She had an adenocarcinoma, so generally think platinum pemetrexed combinations. We typically use carbo pem in that setting. Is there a biologic agent that should be added to it? And I think we have the choice of bevacizumab. And I think in selected patients, we consider cetuximab if you have a contraindication to bevacizumab. But nowadays, I'm finding that there are increasingly fewer and fewer patients that have contraindications to the use of bevacizumab nowadays.
So just to clarify, though, also in terms of this woman's life situation and kind of what her goals were. You said she had back pain. Did you think about radiation therapy?
Yeah. So before starting treatment, she did get palliative radiotherapy to the lumbar spine.
So you didn't really have any tumor-related symptoms that needed to be palliated at the time you started therapy?
No, other than the lower back pain. And yeah, she was given bisphosphonate after that time as well as part of the therapy.
So Mark, best guess what you think you might have given this woman?
She had no brain mets.
She did not have brain mets.
So probably, and no hemoptysis?
No hemoptysis. So we deemed her bevacizumab eligible.
Yeah, she had no contraindications to Bev. So, you know, I think that the FDA-approved choices here are carbo-tax Bev or cis-pemetrexed. I think those would be equally good. And generally, patients who don't have contraindications to Bev, I will use it, obviously. And increasingly, for better or for worse, we're coming to the end of the Point Break trial, which this patient at our institution would be presented with the Point Break or JMHD trial, which would randomize her to carbo-paclitaxel Bev versus carbo-pemetrexed Bev for four cycles, and then a slightly different maintenance strategy with Bev alone on the paclitaxel arm and the combination of pemetrexed Bev after the four cycles of carbo-pem-Bev.
So that's the old Sandler versus Patel.
Yeah.
Became Point Break.
Exactly.
Sandler versus Patel is easy to remember.
And just to remind everyone, Alan Sandler was the PI on the phase 3 pivotal ECOG trial looking at bevacizumab, paclitaxel, and carboplatin, with Bev continued as maintenance after the chemo. And Jody Patel was the PI of a phase 2 study of pemetrexed, carboplatin, and bevacizumab, followed by bevacizumab and pemetrexed maintenance. But bottom line, off study, best guess about what you think you would have given to her?
Off-study, probably carbo, pemetrexed, Bev. In my experience, that's been a very well-tolerated regimen.
And as you began that, what would you have been thinking about what was going to be your next step? And obviously, it's going to depend how she tolerates it or responds to it. But longer term, what would you be thinking about after the chemo?
What I say to patients is, you know, this is not curable disease, it's treatable disease. We're going to really do our first reassessment about where to go next after four cycles. I talk a little bit about the issues with regard to maintenance or subsequent therapies and stuff like that. I will admit, off trial, I have generally, with this regimen, I have not necessarily followed the Patel strategy of continuing both PEM and BEV as maintenance. I've generally dropped just to BEV maintenance alone, even though that's not an evidence-based approach. It's kind of continuation maintenance, as the NCCN would call it. But that's kind of what we do. So that's generally what I would do in most patients.
So we understand that there are multiple evidence-based options, but one of the things we like to do is just find out in general what you do. So I'll ask you, Rogerio. Again, this is obviously a very common situation. In general, how do you approach a patient like this?
So I would approach more or less the same way Mark outlined. I would use a carbo-based doublet with bevacizumab, probably at this point, just for a practical reason, carbotaxane InBev because we're trying to support Mark's CALGB second-line trial with pemetrexed. So we are using that as our second-line approach.
Which taxane usually?
It would be paclitaxel.
And as you thought about the next step, what would you be thinking once you're finished with the carbo-paclitaxel?
So she would, provided that she is stable or had a response to this regimen, I would keep her on Bev maintenance. And at that point, based on the Saturn data, I would probably have a discussion in the Atlas. In fact, perhaps more specifically, I would have a discussion about a switch maintenance option. But I don't automatically do that in my practice.
Specifically what?
Either pemetrexed or erlotinib. In this case, I would be inclined more towards erlotinib than pemetrexed.
With the Bev or not?
With the Bev.
Ed, how do you approach a patient like this?
I would go with carboplatin and either pemetrexed or docetaxel with bevacizumab. You know, everybody talks about the Patel regimen, and Jody's a great friend of mine, but William published our experience, Dr. William did, with carbo-docetaxel bevacizumab in cancer this past year, and we had response rates over 50% and median survival of 16 months. We give growth factor support.
Greg?
There has to be somebody here who stands up for a cisplatin-based initial treatment for stage 4.
Mark Chris would be very proud of you.
That's right.
He's trained you well. Let the record know.
With bevacizumab, Greg? Or without bevacizumab?
I would give cisplatin, pemetrexed, bevacizumab as my first line therapy for this patient. And I acknowledge that the cisplatin, pemetrexed, bevacizumab is not an evidence-based approach, but I think it sort of offers the best of all worlds for the patient.
So just to get the specific flavors, because the real question is not just so much what you start with, but kind of what's your 6-12-month plan. So Ed, so if you do carbo, pem, bev, what's your next planned move?
Right. So extending off of what Mark and Rogerio were talking about, I continue Bev alone. I do not do the doublet maintenance. And if I see progression that occurs not as new disease, but as existing disease that is starting to grow slowly, then someone who's on maintenance Bev, I will, again, in a non-evidence-based manner, add either PEM or erlotinib at that point.
And you said the other alternative would be carbo, PEM, Bev. What's your next move there?
So with carbo-pem-bev, again, I continue the bev, and I will either add erlotinib. With the carbo-docetaxel bev, then I have the option of either adding pem to the bev or erlotinib to the bev upon progression. When it's new disease, I stop the bev and I go something totally different.
Same question. Your second move after cis, pem, bev?
I don't routinely practice switch maintenance, so I maintain patients on pemetrexed bevacizumab. With the initiation of cisplatin or carboplatin, we all know that 4 to 6 cycles in, patients kind of get sick of that element of it. And so I find that most of my patients are on pemetrexed bevacizumab alone at 5 or 6 cycles in, and then I keep them on that until any evidence of progressive disease. And at evidence of progressive disease, I stop both agents and move to a second line.
You know, this thing, we want to talk about biologics and all the new exciting things, but you know, I can't overlook this issue with cis. What do you actually see in your patients in terms of how they tolerate it compared to what you've seen with carbo and what other people see?
Yeah, I think that, you know, giving cisplatin is the hard part. So the hydration, the antiemetics, that's the key element of it. But once you do that, I think that a majority of patients handle it just as well and in some ways better with less myelosuppression. There certainly are patients who do badly with it, though. You know, hearing problems, kidney problems, and you have to be on the lookout for those things, and you have to ask the patients about it, and you have to make a switch as soon as you notice it.
Is there an age? Of course, yeah, we're going to look at physiologic age, but still, you know, 75 and 85 is 75 and 85. Is there an age where you just don't think about cis?
I have a hard time convincing myself to give cisplatin over carboplatin over the age of 70.
Okay, so John, we had 4 different plans. What actually happened?
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think the group outlined all the major things we considered. So the Sandler regimen with carbo-paclitaxel and bevacizumab, the Patel regimen with pemetrexed-based platinum doublets at MD Anderson based on Ed Kim's study, the docetaxel combination has very high activity. The first thing we did, we actually tried to enroll her in the first-line SWOG trial. So this is testing bevacizumab, carboplatin, paclitaxel with or without cetuximab. And she was from South Dakota, so we have patients who will travel quite a distance, but there was a SWOG site nearby. turned out her insurance wouldn't permit her to enroll on a trial like that.
Okay, so what did you actually do?
Well, actually, at the end of all that ended up doing was having the plan of a fusion essentially between the Patel and the Sandler regimens of carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab, but then doing switch maintenance with pemetrexed and bevacizumab. She was clear up front that she wanted to be very aggressive and really, if there's a possibility that something would be providing additional maintenance. Now, when it came time after completing six cycles of therapy, she was a little beaten up at that point, fatigued, and really her focus became a little bit more on quality of life, and we ended up just giving maintenance bevacizumab. So at the end of all that, it was the ECOG 4599 regimen, and then adding pemetrexed when she progressed. And in this case, we added the pemetrexed to the bevacizumab. Instead of discontinuing the bevacizumab, we put the two together.
So she first got bevacizumab alone.
Right, as maintenance.
For how long?
On the order of 2 to 3 months.
And how was she doing at that point?
She did well from a symptoms perspective.
So she kind of started to feel better getting off the chemo?
Yeah, and she had initially had a moderate response. I don't know if it was an official PR, but it was at least a minor response with symptomatic improvement. And she maintained that for a couple months on bevacizumab.
What symptoms did she have that got better? Because you said she got her back radiated.
Yeah, you know, she had some shortness of breath and she had some other minor pains from osseous metastases, but they weren't debilitating and that all improved somewhat.
And then what happened that you felt she progressed? Was it clinical or radiologic?
It was radiographic primarily, and she developed an obstructive pneumonia eventually from a lesion. So we ended up adding pemetrexed, and she did not do particularly well on pemetrexed and bevacizumab together. She actually progressed after just two cycles of treatment there.
And then what?
Well, so that left us now with a patient with KRAS mutation who's now progressed after platinum doublet therapy as well as pemetrexed. So decision was an EGFR TKI versus a clinical study. Now, we actually have clinical studies addressing specifically the RAS mutated population that are getting rolling at MD Anderson, and we had one with the MEK inhibitor, AZD6244. So she was evaluated for that. And there's, again, a lot of preclinical work from Memorial Sloan Kettering and elsewhere about the sensitivity of KRAS mutants and more prominently BRAF mutants to MEK inhibition. So that was the rationale for using the MEK inhibitor there. Once again, her insurance wouldn't let her enroll on a study of a MEK inhibitor. So she's actually coming back in the upcoming week, and at this point, the recommendation will likely be erlotinib, with the frank discussion that the response rates are approaching zero for erlotinib, but also to point out from Ed Kim's interest study that when compared to docetaxel in patients with KRAS mutations, the progression-free survival was comparable between those two groups, those receiving docetaxel and those receiving gefitinib. So without much enthusiasm at this point, and in the absence of being able to put her on a clinical trial, recommending erlotinib.
So we want to use this case, just like we used Tom's case earlier, as a way to get into a number of issues. And one thing I want to ask you, Tom, about, there were a couple of papers at ASCO that you were part of. One, looking at the so-called ARIES observational study, kind of reminds me of a similar registry study that Axel Grothy led in colorectal cancer, looking at patients like in a community registry type of setting receiving bevacizumab. What did you all look at in this registry, and what did you report at ASCO?
So in this registry, we looked at approximately 1,800 to 1,900 patients with non-small cell lung cancer metastatic disease treated in community settings around the country. And Neil, I think one of the things that is great about registry studies is they do reflect practice situations very nicely. The only requirement is that the doctor feels the patient would benefit from treatment, but does not prescribe the chemotherapy, does not prescribe a dose, but allows the physician to use their best judgment. And so what we found was doctors in the United States are pretty good at deciding who should get bevacizumab. When you look at the overall rate of serious complication, the serious complication rate is actually less than in Alan Sandler's 4599 trial, with hemoptysis rates that are under 1%. And significant morbidity that looks very good. From this trial, we were able to confirm some of the observations that Mark and others have shown regarding what subgroups of patients look like they can get bevacizumab. We found that patients with brain metastasis and concurrent anticoagulation did very well, that it could be given safely without excess complication rates. And also in a subgroup analysis, looking at the location of tumors, one of the things that didn't come out was this idea. There had been an urban myth about bevacizumab and central tumors for quite some time, and it looks like central tumors were not a contraindication to using bevacizumab.
Anything else that came out of that?
The progression-free survival looked encouraging compared with 45-99. I think the biggest take-home message I got from it is that American docs are doing a great job of deciding who should get Bev in terms of the side effect profile being very manageable.
Mark?
One of my concerns, I mean, I think that registry is a great idea. And I echo your comment about the general community oncologist is exercising good judgment in who gets Bev and who doesn't get Bev because of the toxicity data. The one thing that bothers me about that toxicity data is it looks actually better than 45-99 data. And if I understand it correctly, to get on that registry, you have up to like 4 months right. after starting bevacizumab to put the patient on. So one of my concerns is that
all
you have
the train wrecks being excluded.
You have a pulmonary hemorrhage first cycle. Well, let's not, you know, maybe we shouldn't put them on ARIES.
Absolutely.
So I think we have to be a little cautious in saying that. And then the other thing, this colon thing drives me nuts. You know, it's been used to justify therapy that was not done in a randomized fashion and all that kind of stuff. And I think you cannot draw conclusions about treatment paradigms from a registry because the better patients get treated more and they do better.
I want to use this as an opportunity to get into, since you know this patient got carbopaclitaxel, the data that Mark presented at ASCO and nab-paclitaxel. But before I do, I want to just jump right back though to this maintenance issue. It's now been a year, more than a year since ASCO 2009 that this really popped into our heads. You know, Chandra Balani's work, and there was more stuff presented at ASCO, Greg. And initially, I think people are trying to process this. What does this mean? Is this early second-line therapy? Now, at this point, Greg, how do you think through all the maintenance data that's been presented over the past year? What do you think it means to docs in practice?
That's an easy question to answer. Yeah. It's such an extraordinarily complex area, and I think that these are decisions that each, you know, again, you're making it in the exam room with the patient, and you're talking with them about, you know, break from therapy versus continuation of something that they know. You know, for instance, if you're starting the patient on a pemetrexed chemotherapy combination, then you continue them on that as a continuation maintenance. They understand that. They're comfortable with it, and you compare those sorts of experiences, and you talk about it. My bias is not to do switch maintenance, it's to do continuation maintenance, and you know, we'll probably talk in a little bit about some of the gemcitabine data for continuation maintenance for or against. So it's not a clear-cut picture as to what the right thing to do is, but in my mind, we have a certain number of drugs we can give for a patient with stage 4 lung cancer, and I don't want to burn too many bridges too soon.
So, Ed, what's your take on this? You know, when I first saw it, I was thinking, well, you're just kind of trying to get second-line therapy in quicker. I remember talking to Mark right after ASCO last year, and he brought up the issue of, well, maybe you should just watch these people really carefully and try to give them a break, particularly if they haven't gotten a biologic. What are your thoughts at this point?
You know, I think to highlight all of the maintenance data and all of the maintenance controversies or lack thereof that have come out, and as you went through the room and asked us how we would treat this patient, you heard 7 different iterations of similar concepts. I think what maintenance has told us is we are under-treating lung cancer patients. And I don't mean by stacking numbers of chemotherapy, but we need to treat these patients because we know that when we ignore them, they don't get treated. And that means close surveillance is also acceptable or with supportive care aspects, you know, of what's coming out. But we have to be there following them and not give up on things because when we ignore them, they fall off, they don't get second line therapy, and their survivals drop. So we clearly know when we back off and we sort of don't want to be intensive with supportive care or don't want to be intensive with a maintenance therapy or a second line therapy or a third line therapy, survivals will go down. So I think the message from all of this data is we have to pay attention to these patients. First time they get debilitated because of a pneumonia or because they have pain, don't give up. Incorporate supportive care. Get them ready for treatment because we know they can take more treatment.
Mark?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, in that initial discussion that I have with my patients about this, you know, I've coined the phrase that treating lung cancer is like the game of baseball. Everyone should get 3 strikes. And we've got 3 lines of approved therapy. And I tell patients, you have lots of therapeutic options. My intent is to get you multiple treatments over time. There may be times that we're going to transition right to another treatment, or it may be time that I think that you might have the ability to stop treatment and have a treatment break for a while. The point is that this is not curable. that there are multiple options. You can't do everything at the same time. But I think Ed's right. I think as thoracic oncologist here, the message we have to give to the generalist is that if patients don't get the therapies can't help them. And I do think that there is this sense of historic therapeutic nihilism with this disease, that this is a tough disease to treat. But I think that's different now. I mean, Arthur Skarin taught me when I was a fellow that this is a one-and-done disease. You know, at that point, we gave him cisplatin, Adriamycin, and Cytoxan, you know, the old CAP regimen when I was a fellow. And when they progressed, Arthur said, oh, you know, hospice. And that was it. And that's changed. I mean, it was 20 years ago I finished my fellowship. A lot has changed in 20 years.
See, I want the baseball analogy to be not three strikes and you're out anymore. It's going to be get up there for that 14-pitch at bat.
Yeah.
Foul ball, yeah. As many balls
right,
as you can.
That's fine. That's fine.
You know, those are strikes too, but you know, it's just not a miss.
So I'd say a couple of things. I don't think we, you know, the lung cancer community didn't invent this concept of maintenance.
Right.
You know, this is the way that the breast cancer docs have treated people forever. It's the way our colorectal cancer colleagues have treated people forever. It's the way oncologists in practice treat those diseases. And ovarian cancer. Yeah. Where they switch from active chemotherapy regimens sequentially. The reason we never did it in lung cancer is because our therapies are more toxic and our patients are sicker and more infirm, and we grabbed on to this concept of giving a treatment break or a treatment holiday. So, you know, I think that the maintenance data is real. I think it's unfortunate that we landed on the word maintenance, but we have to use it, and I think that trying to redefine it is crazy. But I really look at it as applying second-line therapy to more people. More people get second-line therapy, your group is going to do better, which is why I like the idea of switch maintenance as an appealing concept in the way we treat patients. But I think it's hard to look at JMEM and not come away impressed that there are groups of patients that are falling through the cracks. And I was involved in almost every one of the maintenance trials as a site investigator. And, you know, we did our best to give that second line therapy to people, and they didn't always get it.
Right.
So let me ask Rogerio, though, if you kind of take a global look back, seeing lung cancer patients all the time, knowing that these people are destined to die of their disease, do you think that when it's all said and done and the patient has died and you look back on what happened, that you feel a sense of, if you're more aggressive about using maintenance or early second line or whatever you want to call it, that the patient's either quality or quantity of life globally overall that you've helped?
Yes, I do. So I think the addition of newer interventions, perhaps a little earlier than we would do otherwise or we did in the past, I think in general does lead to a prolongation of survival or at least progression-free survival. And to some extent, improved or at least not worse quality of life.
John?
Well, to a point that's been made here by Tom and others, the data suggests that if you get the second line therapy, you have as much benefit as if you had received it in the maintenance therapy. The best study evidence from that is probably Panosfidius' study. And there, that was with maintenance docetaxel. And overall, maintenance docetaxel did have a benefit in terms of prolonging progression. It did have a benefit that almost achieved statistical significance in terms of prolonging overall survival. And that was randomizing patients to either early docetaxel or late docetaxel at progression. So it was really the best designed study in that regard, better than JMEN in that everybody was designed to get docetaxel. But if you took just the patients who got the docetaxel, they came out to be the same, whether they got it as maintenance therapy or they got it later. And while the numbers for JMEN are impressive about maintenance pemetrexed, of course, we know the shortcoming that the patients who didn't receive maintenance pemetrexed didn't have the option of crossing over to pemetrexed in a lot of cases. So if we're choosing, for example, between whether to add bevacizumab to a regimen or to add pemetrexed maintenance, if we're choosing between those two, if we say we're just going to follow evidence from phase three studies and phase three question with pemetrexed and bevacizumab hasn't been answered yet, you'd look at that and say, well, the evidence for pemetrexed, actually the hazard ratios are better for JMEN than they are for ECOG 4599, but it does have that shortcoming about the crossover. So the overall message is that as long as patients get second-line therapy, they probably benefit as much as if they get the therapy in the maintenance setting. But inevitably, and this happened in Panosfidius, you lose 20 or 30% of patients who never end up getting second-line therapy as a result. And the biggest problem, in my mind, is if a patient with an EGFR mutation doesn't end up getting an EGFR inhibitor. That's where we miss the biggest opportunity for dramatic benefit.
Yeah. So same argument for ALK in crizotinib.
Same argument. Same argument as well.
Yeah. And this is not to say that treatment breaks are not important. I really think that's a concept that cannot be lost, you know, because this is a long process. People do benefit from it. You know, they ask for it. And again, even though we may miss a patient or two as we follow them, even if we follow them closely, I try to the best of my ability to give people breaks. And I think in the long run, that gives them a sense of control and a sense of well-being that is a little bit lost with maintenance continuous, you know, treatment.
Although, you know, I wonder if you look at, a lot of you have talked about bevacizumab alone and what you see there. Of course, they have to come into the office. But I mean, is it your impression, Rosaria, that using Bev alone as maintenance affects quality of life other than having to come to the office? Do you think they feel there's a fraction? I don't know if you looked at that in areas that you think, you know, has some kind of quality of life problem.
No. So for most patients who are on maintenance Bev, they don't mind the infusion. They don't mind coming to the office. I don't see them every time they come. You know, so it doesn't seem to have an impact on their quality of life, perhaps as much as an active drug or a different type of drug would have.
Mark?
And I think we're all struggling with who we should maintain and who can have a treatment break. And I was recently putting together a talk where I have to kind of talk about maintenance erlotinib. And one of the issues is looking at the Saturn data broken out by your response to those four cycles. And actually, in Europe, my understanding, although I haven't seen the language, erlotinib is indicated for maintenance only for patients with stable disease, because they broke out in the patients who had a good CRPR, didn't get any benefit from maintenance with regard to survival or PFS. I'm not quite sure about PFS.
And you know
PFS.
What's even more interesting, too?
In the
is
same thing.
The J-men.
The same the thing same is true thing. On the pemetrexed trial.
Exactly. Can you come up with an intuitive explanation of it?
Well,
or how about random error?
I think it makes great sense.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Those are the people who fall off the
exactly.
track.
Right.
Is the people with the good PRs, you have time to catch them and get them in a second line.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the person who doesn't have the good PR who's
are more
kind
likely
of fragile.
To relapse early.
You know? More likely to have the massive PE that you never get them to
treat. The people who really need the treatment are getting the treatment when they should, whereas those people who can have treatment breaks who feel well. Because the most common question I get asked about cycle 3 or 4 is, when can I take a break?
Can we skip this?
Because, you know, it is cumulatively toxic therapy. And in those patients that have had a great response, you know, those 20 to 30% that have very nice response, their symptoms are resolved, they've gained 5 to 7 pounds, their appetite's better. I say, yeah, your cancer's controlled, you're telling me it's controlled, your CAT scan looks better, let's take a break. I'll see you every 4 weeks. And the rules are, if something happens, come early. Don't wait 4 weeks to see me. But, you know, just kind of do that. Whereas the other people, the stable disease patients, they're still a little sick. And they haven't had a dramatic response. And they aren't necessarily the ones that are feeling better as a result of their therapy. And so you have that sense. And that's how my thinking is changing on this whole thing.
So my favorite quote so far of 2010 was at ASCO when I interviewed Mark. And he said something about, tumors are albumin sponges.
Oh, yeah.
I like that one. So with that as an introduction, Mark, can you talk about the paper you presented on nab-paclitaxel and a little bit about the background of the study and what you actually looked at?
So I don't think anyone here would argue that taxane-based therapy is well cemented into the treatment of lung cancer. Carboplatin has been our national standard for years, even before phase 3
data. It's been the national vitamin.
That's right. That's right. And so there have been a number of efforts to try to make taxanes better. And the effort that I've been involved in for a while has been the process of binding it to albumin. So nanoparticle albumin-bound paclitaxel. We started to do some phase 1 studies and phase 2 studies years ago, and I'm not going to go over the breast cancer data, but this was a drug that was first indicated in breast cancer because in a head-to-head comparison, it had better response rates, better PFS, and gained approval. So this is obviously a drug that's out there. Like nab-paclitaxel, there's questions about schedules and all this kind of stuff, but I think more interesting is the biology of this agent in terms of the albumin receptor, the GP60, the process of the calveoli, calveolin 1 levels, this process of transcytosis.
Hold on. Now you got to go back through all that, including calveolin. I still have no idea what it is.
Getting kind of actively transporting.
Calveolin is a transporter?
Calveolin 1 helps form the calveoli that get transported across the endothelial cells. And this has all been demonstrated by electron micrographs and all that kind of stuff. And then once it's there, I can never remember what SPARC stands for. It's secreted protein rich in acidic acid and cysteine residues or something like that. But this is an albumin-binding protein. So teleologically, I've always thought of it as, you know, tumors need protein. I mean, tumors are growing organisms. What a nice way to design it. You're going to suck up the most common protein you have in the body, which is albumin, and use that as your protein source. And isn't it a kind of a novel idea to bind your drug to albumin? That may be a better way to deliver it to where you want the drug going in your vein to end up.
So just before you get into the clinical data, let me give John a shot at his explanation for nab-paclitaxel and albumin and cancers in general and lung cancer specifically.
Well, you know, I think Mark highlighted the potential for active transport and trapping albumin very well in tumors. You know, there's really a couple different processes. So one is active transport. So active transport through endothelial cells means something is binding or going into cavioli or endocytic vesicles, and it gets transported through and put out on the other side. And just remember, any drug you put in the vasculature has to cross an endothelial cell in the blood vessel before it reaches tissue, typically in normal cells and normal tissue. And the second phenomena that's worth pointing out is that tumor vessels are very leaky. So if you look at under EM at a normal endothelial cell, it looks like a road with well cobblestoned or bricks, or very small, tight junctions in between the cells. They're very regular. And when you look in a tumor, it looks like after you drop bombs on a street where it's got holes in it, they're irregular. And so things leak out very easily through tumor vasculature. So if you inject any macromolecules, any big molecules, and we have a variety of different dyes that do that, it should only leak out in places where the endothelium are either intentionally leaky, like when you've got inflammation, or around places like tumors where you've got new blood vessels forming and they don't form very tight. So the bottom line from all that is macromolecules and things like albumin, they can get actively transported and trapped inside a tumor, or they can just leak out through the holes in the vasculature because of the irregularity of tumor vasculature.
So let's get into some clinical data. What did you actually see there in the study?
Well, the study was initially designed to look at response rate. You know, this was an agent that at the time of the design of this trial, carboplatin was out there. It was a regulatory standard. This drug was approved in breast cancer. This was a new formulation of a drug, so it was decided that the endpoint, an acceptable endpoint, was overall response rate. And we can argue about what the appropriate endpoint is, but between the company and the FDA, the endpoint of overall response rate was identified.
With the idea that it was going to be the same or greater?
That it would be greater. They wanted to define it as a superiority trial for the reasons we've been talking about. In breast, it looked like the response rates were significantly higher. So if that biology is true, that should be true in lung cancer.
Also in breast, it kind of looked like it was a randomized phase two, but there was one that looked like it might have been better than docetaxel.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know the breast cancer nab-paclitaxel data as well as I know the lung. Now, if you want to power it just to show superior response rate, it required 400 patients. Much, I think, to the company's credit, they said to the FDA, if we go to physicians with just a response rate, that's not going to be viewed as credible versus having some survival endpoint. So they asked, actually, if they could power the trial to look at progression-free survival. So that took the patient numbers from 400 to over 1,000. And the other concern was that this trial started up kind of when bevacizumab was ramping up. And so how are you going to get a patient on this trial? Now, turns out that roughly two-thirds of the accrual came from the Ukraine and Russia. Pretty much the same sites that got nab-paclitaxel approved in breast cancer. So the trial accrued 1,052 patients or so. The design was to standard carboplatin given with standard pre-medications. The investigation arm has a bit of a history to it in the sense that we...
Incidentally, you're bringing up the Russian ex-US thing because most of the people did not get Bev?
Right. It was easy to accrue there because there was no option to give...
So you didn't allow Bev-treated patients?
No. This was a totally Bev-naive study. The investigational arm was a same dose of carbo, same schedule every 3 weeks, but the nab-paclitaxel was given at 100 milligrams per meter squared weekly. And that was decided upon because we had done a phase two looking at seven different cohorts of either every 3 week or weekly nab-paclitaxel. And I've described that trial as a horse race. You have seven horses. You can only pick one to go to phase three. And I remember years ago, Mike Hawkins, who was developing this drug at that time, made a very compelling argument that it should be this particular arm, that in his view, you know, it was hard to tell because there were 25 patients in each of the 7 cohorts. You got to pick a winner. You can only pick one winner, and that's what we picked. So anyway, the nice thing about it is there were no pre-medications that were required for that. The trial met its primary endpoint. We powered the study off of ECOG 1594, the carboplatin arm, where the response rate was, I think, 15% or so. And we were looking for a 40% increase, so up to about 22%. In reality, the control arm had a response rate of 25% and the nab-paclitaxel arm 33% by independent radiologic review. So the investigators reviewed it. Their response rates were generally a little bit higher, but the same magnitude difference. So at the end of the day, it was a positive phase 3 trial. We don't have any data on PFS yet. We're expecting that between now and the end of the year. When the data first came out, I said to the company, you know, we live in a histology-dominated world, so we need to look at this by histology. And we did. Histology analysis for response was not pre-specified, but it was a stratification factor. We had a high percentage of squamous, I think because of the areas where patients came from. And
well,
interesting,
you also didn't allow Bev.
Right.
So maybe that was the reason you got
squamous. That was certainly the reason at our site.
Right.
Was, you know, patients who were eligible for Bev didn't go on this trial. So it was principally the squamous patients at our site that went on. So the squamous had, on carboplatin, a response rate of 24% versus 41%. So there's a huge benefit of response in the squamous, which raises a whole bunch of different issues about these things that we're talking about in terms of GP60 and caveolin-1 levels and spark levels and all those sorts of things that are theoretical reasons why there may be differences in activity.
Just quick transfer over to John. Any reason to think squamous would have more of these albumin-related issues?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting point. And until Mark just discussed this here, I hadn't actually made this connection. So it turns out caveolin-1 is higher in squamous cell carcinoma. So we actually have a proteomics paper showing this that's in press right now by Lauren Byers and Muren Anjindan.
And I don't know about your paper, but in historic papers, yeah, it portends a poor prognosis.
Right, it's prognostic.
But it's been known that caveolin-1 is greater in squamous?
Well, if I remember the data that I've seen, I'm not aware of John's data. What I saw is there are several papers looking at caveolin-1 in squamous. Now, they don't compare across the histologies, but in squamous, it's a poor prognostic finding.
Yeah. But so when we actually just compare levels, and this is by either immunohistochemistry or reverse phase proteomic array, actually, if we take the top 4, looking at dozens of proteins, the top 4 that discriminate between squamous and adenocarcinoma are actually caveolin-1, cyclin B, phosphosarc, and P70S6 kinase, part of the PI3 kinase pathway. And again, that actually, as I mentioned, this is in press, and it's an observation that we hadn't connected before with MOXR.
Has this been reported or looked at before by other groups?
So as Mark said, caveolin-1 has been reported to be a prognostic factor. It's actually a complicated prognostic factor because it portends a poor prognosis in non-small cell. It's actually a favorable prognostic factor in small cell.
So in the squames, it was an impressive difference. In the non-squames, there really didn't seem to be any difference in activity between paclitaxel and nab-paclitaxel in the non-squames. In terms of response rates, both are about 25%. So
What about side effects and tolerability, in this study, but also in your experience? Has anybody used, other than Mark, NAB in lung cancer?
We had a trial with Abraxane in lung cancer.
You did? You did? Okay, because I want to get your take on clinically. It's hard for me to sort out how it kind of plays out. What did you see actually in the study in terms of side effects and toxicity?
There were 4 significant observations. There was less neuropathy on the NAB-paclitaxel arm, less grade 3-4 neuropathy, 3% versus 10%. I don't quite know how to interpret that because we know there's less neuropathy with weekly taxane schedules. And this was weekly nab-paclitaxel versus every 3-week paclitaxel. Less neutropenia for nab-paclitaxel, but no difference in rates of febrile neutropenia, which were very low on both arms. There was more anemia and more thrombocytopenia. I don't have data yet about the rate of transfusions and all that kind of stuff on the nab-paclitaxel arm. So some slight differences, but in general, pretty low rates of grade 3 or 4 toxicities.
And what do you actually observe clinically? You know, we've been talking, obviously, to docs about this in breast cancer. I can't quite figure it out in terms of, you know, you have the issue of the shorter infusion and the lack of steroids. Some docs seem to value that in terms of breast cancer. How do you globally sort of put this thing together after having treated a bunch of patients?
Well, my bias is that there are some biologic reasons why this may be a more effective taxane. And it is different. You know, I'm not quite sure if it's optimally best to use this as an every 3 week drug or weekly drug. It is easier for patients. It's a 10-15 minute infusion. You don't have to worry about the pre-medications. The neuropathy, if they get it, the general sense, I'm not sure that I have enough experience with this, but the general sense is that the neuropathy regresses quicker. You know, it may be that with solvent-based taxanes, particularly paclitaxel, that, you know, there is certainly toxicity from the solvent. I don't think anyone disagrees with that. And that may be less reversible than it is with the actual antineoplastic drug. So I think it's a kinder, gentler taxane that's more effective.
Let me ask you the question that from what you've seen, Mark just talked about the most recent data. If the cost and reimbursement issue were identical to paclitaxel, what would you be doing right now?
I'd give a vaccine.
Tom?
Yeah, I think that's what we're all saying.
But, you know,
I'm not saying I give it over pemetrexid. That's
right.
That's another issue. What about the issue of steroids? Is that an issue at all in lung cancer patients?
I think it is an issue in lung cancer patients. I think it was one of the things that made people like gemcitabine so much is there weren't a use of steroids in the use of that drug. I think it will be an issue when we think about some of these immune drugs. We're going to talk a little bit later on about ipilimumab, and we might talk about PD-1, anti-PD-1, both of which monoclonal antibodies that modulate the immune system. I think we'd like to get away from steroids. Nab-paclitaxel becomes a very appealing partner.
John?
You know, one other issue now is as we're moving to more and more combination therapies and, you know, 3 and 4 drug combinations that we're testing, for me, the biggest factor is we don't have data with it in combination with these other regimens. So while if I was considering just carboplatin and paclitaxel versus the combination here with NAB, it may be easier to pick it in that setting. But now if you start talking about, let's say, the incorporation of bevacizumab.
We have data on that, don't we?
Well, randomized data, you know. So for me, this randomized data would be sufficient if we were just doing doublets versus doublets. This would be a sale for me. But putting the cost issue and chair time issues aside, you know, now if we start talking about the addition of bevacizumab and other targeted agents, that's where I think there's a little bit more reluctance to take an unapproved regimen like that when you're talking about 3-drug. I believe it likely would work, but I also recognize the limitations of just assuming all chemo is the same. So we saw that carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab, good hazard ratios. And we look at the AVAIL study, much worse hazard ratios. And they've seen this, and that's with gemcitabine and cisplatin. And in colorectal, there are big differences between IFL combinations and FOLFOX. So I think the chemo combination with bevacizumab does make a difference, I wouldn't want to extrapolate.
Is this, you know, a lot of people do sort of view this as a different drug than paclitaxel. Another way to look at it is it's paclitaxel.
Right. I guess there's less of a leap that you're making. If this was a chemo that we never heard of, you know, then the barrier would be much higher. I think the fact that it's paclitaxel with some modifications lowers that bar for jumping, let's say, to a combination with NAB, carboplatin, and bevacizumab. It wouldn't take a lot of evidence before I did that. But to me, the part that's impressive here is the difference in squamous cell carcinoma.
So that's a very important factor.
Okay. So I actually want to move on and talk about the BATTLE study, which has been one of my favorite topics of conversation for a while. So I'll ask Ed if you can talk about both a paper that you presented at AACR and that your colleague Roy Herbst presented at ASCO on this study, what you all looked at and what you reported.
So BATTLE is a phase 2 program, and that's the first thing we have to keep in mind. It's not a definitive phase 3, but the goal of BATTLE, when we sat down and planned this about 5 years now, was to try and approach lung cancer patients who had been previously treated in a different manner. And the major crux of that was, can we get fresh tissue, and not just fine needle aspirates, but good pieces of tissue, core biopsies, in these folks? We also wanted to make sure that patients would all receive adequate treatment that we deemed to be with drugs that still had activity. So at the time, we picked the drugs based on their pathways, EGFR pathway being erlotinib, which was not approved at the time when we selected it. It was subsequently approved afterwards. Sorafenib, which was being studied in multiple tumors, vandetanib as well, and then the combination of erlotinib and vixarotene based on the Dartmouth group with Konstantin Dragnev and others who were studying it. And each of those had markers that we could sort of speculate that they may have enhancements. Now, again, going back to 2004, 2005, Tom and the Boston group had just reported on EGFR mutations, and that was really the only thing that was coming out. And if you remember back even at that time, EGFR mutations were not the sort of dictum. There was a big discussion between FISH and mutations based on even the BR21 data, which actually stated that FISH was more, or the gene amplification was more predictive than mutations. So we grouped markers based on these pathways. So the EGFR group contained both mutation as well as FISH. The KRAS group also include BRAF. In the RXR cyclin D1, we had multiple markers. And then in the VEGF, we had a couple of markers as well. So in total, there were 11 markers that we looked at in four different groups.
And John, you were involved also with this study, and you were telling me it had an unusual design. I think you said it was a Bayesian design. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Sure. So what a Bayesian design means is that you're essentially learning from the trial as you go along. So when we think a conventional study design, you set up your arms and you set up your criteria for who gets treated with what, and then it runs itself through the course of the study. That randomization doesn't change, whether it's 1-to-1 or 1-to-2. Here, based on the markers, and the markers were done in real time, as Ed was mentioning, it would affect the likelihood of being randomized to one of the four treatments. So, for example, if one arm was sorafenib and a patient did well on sorafenib that had a particular marker profile, then that changed the likelihood of the next patient who had that marker profile getting sorafenib. So you're essentially moving the randomization as you go along. And the hope is that that's a more efficient way to come up with markers that are associated with better outcome as you go along. So you want to treat more patients with more effective therapies is the goal of that design.
And that really leads to the reason the assessment one is 8-week disease control. Because in a adaptive design, if you use progression-free survival, you're actually going to hinder the benefit received by some patients to be able to incorporate it real-time into the model. If you use 8-week disease control, you have a set point, you'll be able to make an assessment, and then in very quick time, use that information for the next patient and the next patient.
And were you sitting down and just sort of looking at all this stuff, or was there a computer model that was doing it, or both?
There is a computer model that does it with any statistical aspect, but part of the real-time aspect is we have to get the assessment at 8 weeks. More importantly, before that, we have to get the markers done, and all these markers were done within a 2-week period of time. So we really felt that there had to be timely, efficient sort of evaluations done so patients were not waiting around not being treated. We were able to get biopsies on new patients within a week and have their markers done within 2 weeks.
So what did you report?
So the primary endpoint of the study was to look at overall 8-week disease control in the entire population, and that was 46%. And we used, in a third-line population, 30% as a historical control. So that was better than what we thought it would be. The way the design was done, and this was the first step, was that about the first half of the patients were equally randomized. And that was really to build up information to see how different marker profiles and patients were responding as far as 8-week disease control. Once we had all that information built in for the first 97 patients it was, then we switched to adaptive. And that information then was used to help formulate probabilities on which biomarker groups may in fact get more benefit with therapies. We were able to complete the study in less than 3 years. So really astounding from that standpoint that we enrolled over 300 patients and were able to randomize over 200 patients into the study in less than a 3-year period of time, all with core biopsies up front.
So what did you report?
So the subset data was really what was quite fascinating, and it has to be viewed that way. There were different numbers of patients enrolled to each one of the arms, and they were each separate studies under an umbrella study. For instance, sorafenib study enrolled the most number of patients, 101 patients. And what was fascinating about it was we have marker profiles on each one of those patients. What was very intriguing and is hypothesis generating was the fact that those patients who had a KRAS mutation did very well, had a 61% disease control rate while taking sorafenib. On the flip side, if you didn't have a KRAS mutation, you also did very well. 56% disease control. So KRAS was not a distinguishing factor in patients treated with sorafenib. In fact, The reason why that's important is because, as we know, when we treat other folks with KRAS mutations who harbor them, they don't seem to do as well. And that was true of all the other three therapies, is that their disease control rates were much lower. On the flip side, another observation we made was, again, with the EGFR mutation patients. It's generally known that those folks who have EGFR mutations are going to do a little bit better. They respond a little better. They live a little longer. And in fact, we saw an opposite effect occur with sorafenib. In fact, only 23% of them had disease control. So,
how many people with mutations were in this study?
So we had multiple numbers. I think the exact numbers I have to pull out of the abstract. We had 18 patients with KRAS mutations. Our percentages were right on par with what you report on a regular basis. And I think there were about 60-some-odd patients who did not have. They were wild type. And so those were the denominators that we were looking at. Again, small numbers, but sort of provocative in what we were seeing.
So how do you put this together? And particularly, how do you put together the sorafenib story? That kind of came out of nowhere.
It did. And I think if any one of us had sat around the table, and if it were this group, and we would have ranked the order of which we thought the drugs that would be working today from 5 years ago, we'd probably have erlotinib there. We definitely have vandetanib probably near the top. And bixarotene, erlotinib, only because erlotinib was carrying it, and sorafenib probably would have been a distant fourth, is my guess. And I think the important concept of what we've done here is that no longer when any of us are sitting around at a company designing a study, we don't have to say it can't be done anymore.
Right.
Now you can say, we can do this.
Bravo.
Okay, so that's the most important thing you take away from this study.
Yeah, so John, how about if you take a shot at explaining the translational aspects, and particularly this KRAS/sorafenib thing?
Yeah. Well, as Ed mentioned, in a lot of ways, the most important output, I think, of the study is showing that it's feasible. And one of the things we learned right away with working with Ignacio Estuba is that refractory non-small cell lung cancer that has progressed after platinum is different than primary non-small cell lung cancer. And it may be obvious, but it's important to point out because a lot of our biomarkers are based on resected specimens from surgical patients. But a lot of what we're trying to develop are markers for refractory non-small cell lung cancer. So we've conducted gene expression profiling from the majority of patients, about 170 total. And I think this is the first substantial set of refractory lung cancer that's been profiled like that. Some of these results have been presented by Pierre Santini already. One of them is we see downregulation of the MYC pathway, and that seems to be associated with platinum resistance. By having all this gene expression data, we can develop predictive signatures for the different agents. So, for example, there's a predictive signature now for wild-type EGFR patients to erlotinib. And that's a particularly interesting goal for us because we now have EGFR mutation established as a gold standard marker that I think is irrefutable, but we know patients with wild-type EGFR still benefit, and that's a group we don't have markers for. So,
any hints in that direction? Do we know anything?
Well, we have a 5-gene signature that predicts well. Now, it's preliminary, and we're obviously looking to validate
what
this
kind
on
of
other
genes?
Data sets. So these are genes that are connected. They're not obvious ones like EGFR itself in terms of the gene expression signature, but there are ones that have been mechanistically linked to tyrosine kinases before. And so we're now investigating these scientifically and doing additional work to validate them and, of course, validate these in independent sets. And, you know, Ed pointed out this is a phase two study that's really important for generating hypotheses that we can now validate in larger phase three studies.
So why don't we bring in a patient? I asked you to present one of the patients just to kind of get a real view of how this trial played out.
Yeah, so I thought this one would add a nice little twist. This is a 69-year-old gentleman who was diagnosed in August of 07 with adenocarcinoma stage 4. I don't have exactly all the different areas, but it was a stage 4. It wasn't any nuanced stage 3. Had a 30-pack-year smoking history, and he had quit 16 years prior. So he lived in Texas and came, and he had already been started treatment on the outside. He had received carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab. He unfortunately had bad neuropathy due to the paclitaxel after a couple cycles and switched to gemcitabine. So he then went carboplatin, gemcitabine, and he got a total of 5 doses of chemotherapy. So the first couple with the paclitaxel-based therapy and then with gem. And in October of 07, unfortunately, had progression. So chemo, even with the Bev, was not working in him. Adenocarcinoma, good PS. He was then given erlotinib, and that did not last very long. He only was able to take it for a little over a month because even at starting at 150 and then at 100, he had just very bad diarrhea. And we have patients like that who just, even though it's only 6% of grade 3, he was one of these. And he couldn't even go out to the store without having complications with the diarrhea. So after that, you know, really, we don't know if it worked or didn't work in him, but clearly the side effects were prohibitive. And that's when he came and saw us, and then he was then tested in the BATTLE study.
Now, did you see him yourself?
I did.
And so when you assessed him, where was the disease and where did you decide to biopsy?
Yeah, he had disease in his chest, several areas, as well as in the lymph nodes. And so any patient who was evaluated for BATTLE, we had images, whether they brought them or we had them. They were reviewed by myself, the nurse, and then a radiologist. And once that was done, the interventional radiologist also looked at him. And this could really be done in real time very quickly.
Now, did he come to you specifically to get into the study, or he came to you just for another opinion and you brought it up to him?
He came for another opinion and I brought it up.
And how did he respond to the idea of the study? What was his background? Do you think he kind of understood what you were trying to do?
He was just a typical middle-class working gentleman. He wasn't an executive or a lawyer or anything like that. He actually owned a farm and had several generations of farmers, and his sons were both helping him there. Very down-to-earth family. And he was, frankly, very excited to be part of a study in which we were going to try and get tumor tissue from him to do it. Now, he tends to get a little squeamish up front about any procedure, whether it's blood or anything, but he said, okay, I'll take your word for it. And that was kind of what was out of his mouth.
He was still working or he retired?
He had been slowing down. He sort of was managing more of the operations.
And so you felt like he intuitively could understand what you were doing in terms of the concept of tailoring it to what you saw on the biopsy. Is that what you found in most patients?
Yes. It was really refreshing to approach patients like this because, you know, patients who enter clinical studies are very altruistic from that standpoint. There is this selfish side where they want to be getting the drug or, you know, even in a phase 3, the randomized drug. They don't want placebo. They want that. But they also know that participation in a trial will hopefully help someone else down the road. And what we encountered a lot of in BATTLE, and John can speak to this as well because he saw patients as well, we underestimated how much a patient wants to participate in this type of research. Not that they would know exactly what their markers show, but the fact that if they participate, even undergoing a biopsy, which many of us thought, well, gosh, patients will never agree to that. That was very much a very small minority of patients. But I will be fair on this because, you know, we were very forthright in how we had to explain the design to the patient and the toxicity. So we quoted 40% pneumothorax rates to them because it came straight from our pulmonary and interventional group. We told them it is very possible that they could undergo a biopsy and the recommendation based on their markers could be none of these drugs. So they knew that there was a chance that they could undergo this biopsy, and if the markers didn't fit the therapy, then our recommendation was no.
FYI, what was your pneumothorax rate?
So 11.5% with only one grade 3.
That's amazing.
What actually happened with this man in terms of the procedure, and what did you see in his tumor?
Right. So he had the tumor biopsy done, and he got through just fine. He actually did not have an EGFR mutation or a KRAS mutation, so he was a wild type kind of across the board. And he was randomized to sorafenib because, again, it's based on rank order as how we did it, and he couldn't take either erlotinib arm. So he was going to be limited to the two arms of vendetinib or sorafenib. And so he actually was treated for a year on the study, on sorafenib, after the therapy finally progressed.
What happened to the tumor during the year?
It stayed stable for the first probably 9 months, and then over the last 3 months, slowly began to grow. Although it was ironic, he felt better than he ever had during his entire sort of treatment for cancer.
How did he do in terms of hand, foot, and side effects?
A little bit of hand, foot, for sure. And we dose reduced him once, and it was fine.
Can you sort out for me the sorafenib thing? I'm kind of trying. Is this suggesting? I mean, it sounds like maybe this man might have benefited. Is that your take?
Yeah, I think he extremely benefited from it.
So, I mean, do you think that sorafenib in some way now should be in the algorithm for management of non-small cell?
I think that might be jumping it a little bit there. I think when you look at the data that Joan Schiller presented a few years ago, I think
randomized discontinuation.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was a hint there.
Yes.
Yeah.
What was that? There was enough of a hint to what that was? What did she look at?
So that was basically giving sorafenib, and I think it was sorafenib in one arm, and then it was...
ECOG 25-4.
Everyone got sorafenib for 2 months.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And you randomized it. If you progressed, you went off.
Right.
If you responded, you stayed on. If you had stable disease, you were randomized to stay on it or stop.
That in renal, I think.
Right. And the study was positive. It achieved its primary endpoint of prolonging PFS.
As part of ECOG, I put, I think, 5 patients, and I can tell you I had at least 1 MR. So I am a believer that this drug alone, as third line, probably add something.
And there is the MISSION trial ongoing in which patients who have received essentially 3 lines, so it's a 4th line trial. Mm-hmm. It's sorafenib versus placebo. And it's accruing very well, actually. The target is 600 to 700 patients. It's well over halfway there.
So again, asking a really naive question, if you have a patient with a KRAS tumor, would that mean you'd maybe consider sorafenib more likely off protocol?
So what I can say is, as I've been contacted by people, especially after AACR, about patients, there have been 2 scenarios that have come up. One was, patient has a KRAS mutation, they've been through several lines. I tell them, you know, sorafenib is not an FDA-approved drug for lung cancer. It is approved for a couple other cancers. You can see if you can get a hold of it.
Can they get it paid for?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And some of them do, and some of them don't. The other scenario that's come up is, as people have heard about the sorafenib data, I've asked them, do they have an EGFR mutation? And some of them have. And I said, you know, I would avoid giving a patient sorafenib with an EGFR mutation. And so that's, again, off study.
John?
It's worth pointing out that going into the study, when we assigned the marker groups, the a priori hypothesis was that among the drugs that we tested, sorafenib was a drug that might work for the RAS mutants. And at least as the drug was initially developed, it was in part as a RAF inhibitor. Now, at the concentrations that are achieved clinically, it probably isn't a very good RAF inhibitor, especially compared to the newer drugs like we have, like the Plexicon and GSK and AZD6244. But nevertheless, that was the hypothesis. And so it also has other off-target effects, RET and VEGF receptor as well. You know, it's intriguing that it's the poster child for a drug that promotes stable disease but not responses in renal cell. So in renal cell carcinoma, it was approved on the basis of progression-free survival with roughly a 2% response rate there, but it did prolong progression-free survival fourfold. And so it's interesting. I think a lot of us were skeptical based on the lack of observed single-agent responses in the Gatzenheimer and Blumenschein single-agent studies. But nevertheless, we do have this observation. I think it is intriguing in RAS mutant patients and merits further study. There was recently a study by a Dutch group where they had a smaller cohort. I believe it was 15 patients or so. And again, they saw partial responses in KRAS mutated non-small cell lung cancer with sorafenib. So to me, there's enough of a signal there that it merits a definitive asking of the question.
What do we know about chemo, Greg, in response in KRAS positive patients?
Yeah, the truth is we don't have a lot of data. I think the bias is that we think that patients with KRAS mutations do worse, that the chemotherapy cisplatin-based doublets don't work.
So along those same lines, until ASCO, that's exactly what I believed as well. And I actually put that into a slide at Neil's ASCO symposium. Jean-Charles Saurier came up to me and just was furious that I had said that. And he said that he had just finished a large meta-analysis of looking at how chemo worked in RAS mutants and found that there was no strong evidence to support the idea that people with RAS mutations don't respond to chemotherapy. And he said, Tom, you're out there leading this effort to think that RAS doesn't work in this setting.
And to support that, at ASCO, we actually presented a retrospective analysis of all of our patients with EGFR, KRAS, and all that sort of stuff. And the survivals weren't a lot different for the KRAS mutants.
Yeah. At ASCO this year, so I was the discussant of the Memorial analysis as well as 2 others where it was surgically resected specimens and looking at KRAS prognostically. Turns out it was not a significant prognostic factor, and I made the comment that we didn't have a lot of data about its impact on chemo responsiveness, and after Jean-Charles got done yelling at Tom Lynch, he came over and yelled at me for not citing his meta-analysis, which had just come out, and I have to admit I hadn't seen ahead of time. So.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty and the co-chair, Dr. Tom Lynch, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special Clinical Investigator Think Tank on non-small cell lung cancer.